You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Hoor Arifi, who is an Afghan activist who has been involved with humanitarian works in Afghanistan since he was a young boy, which is not that long ago. He has worked as a coordinator with the Afghan Peace Volunteers while living in Afghanistan. He is currently majoring in politics and business at a U.S. university. He also works as a facilitator with the Afghan diaspora communities, trying to solve problems faced by Afghans at home and abroad. Hoor Arifi, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David, and for your warm words.
Thank you for what you're doing. Tell us briefly about when you grew up and what your childhood was like in Afghanistan.
Wow. I think that's a complicated question, but I think defining childhood now with having some years experience living in Italy, now in U.S., I think I had no childhood, and it is true today that 80% of Afghanistan population, they do not know their birth date just because they have been living and growing up through wars all their life. So my childhood, I grown up in a central part of Afghanistan under the Taliban area. But after 2001, I lived under, like, and grown up under NATO era strike for 15 years. So I don't know what specifically should I maybe, like, talk about my childhood, but it's not easy to be young and grown up in Afghanistan, because you can find death and fear on daily basis, and on top of all this, because there is a proxy war being fought for decades and decades now, or a lot of people, they have this mindset and mentality that nothing can change for better in the country. And I think through all my time back in Afghanistan, I tried to fight inside and outside to change that fixed definition on Afghanistan. And
what,
yeah.
What year were you born?
I born in 1998, and but still, I am traumatized a lot from going back in 2001 when we moved to Kabul, because the state of our life wasn't very peaceful in the village that we were living. And we thought that maybe with living in Kabul, we will have a good life. But Kabul was a nightmare in that time for me and my family. And I think nights that I was trying to sleep, I couldn't actually fall asleep, because here often young people see the stars. I wear clean air, but I was seeing bullets flowing like stars in the Kabul's air. And it was a pretty hard time for me and my family. And I think I can't find any certain memories while living in Afghanistan.
And when did you become involved with the Afghan Peace Volunteers? And can you tell us something about them? This is a group that I met with when I visited Kabul some years back.
So Afghan Peace Volunteers, I began my journey with them in 2013. I guess I was 13 years old. And that was when me coming back from Pakistan. So Afghan Peace Volunteers are the first non-political organization in Afghanistan who are working under three umbrella, trying to educate the younger Afghans about wars, about the inequalities that their society is facing, and they're trying to build a green and equal world with a world for all children in Afghanistan and in the world. And they're a big opposed of wars and NATO, like the wars in general and also NATO wars in Afghanistan. And they believe in non-violence and the power of love, that it can heal the country and the devastated situation in Afghanistan. They plan trees, not bombs, and they take care of not only kids, but also women during the winters. Who a lot of Afghans are dying every year because of the catastrophic winter that is facing them.
It's a wonderful organization, Afghan Peace Volunteers, for planting trees, not bombs, and for all the work that they've been doing for so many years. How did you end up leaving? You mentioned going to Pakistan. You also went to Italy and to the United States. How did that happen?
I felt going back and forth. I was so rebellious. Seeing the situation of my people in Pakistan, I feel, and having the advantage of reading a lot of history and fiction books, I guess that gave me the opportunity to reflect more deeply about my life and my vision and at that time and the environment that I was surrounded and growing up. And so in Pakistan, I spent a chunk of months, and that was 2 months. And I saw a lot of my Afghan fellows in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa living every day of their life as it is the last day of their life, because I traveled in Pakistan during the winter and it was freezing. I feel that if I hadn't the chance to move in a hotel, I would have been like died. But I saw a lot of kids and my Afghan fellows like living in tents with lack of water, lack of food, and then the catastrophic cold that was facing them. And that was a good time for me to reflect about my country and also a little about the younger people in Afghanistan. And although I have had a lot of impetus in my life, I made the decision to go back to Afghanistan and trying to fill up this emptiness in someone else's life. And pretty much ever since inside and outside, I have been struggling with my current work with the Afghan diaspora communities, and abroad, trying to fill up some of these impetus that we had, and now that we have some resources to share it with our Afghan fellows who are stuck amid conflict in Afghanistan. And Italy is another story, I guess. So it's not very easy to be an activist and living in a war zone, because the voices of younger people in Afghanistan are oppressed so easily, and some of the work that I was doing to point out our government on the rights of women, so that brought me a lot of risk, and I had to think of probably living for some more years when I was, 17. So I found that is scholarship to study for 2 years for my higher school in Italy, and I went to Italy, and then after graduating from one of the UWC colleges, I found another chance to come, and now I study at one of the U.S. universities.
And here in the United States, you're working with other people displaced from Afghanistan, helping them adjust and do well here, as well as trying to help people back in your country, in Afghanistan?
Yes, David. So I have been trying to connect all the Afghan diaspora communities worldwide to send help and resources to Afghanistan. It's funny because U.S. is the main obstacle of any civilian war in Afghanistan, and they're the ones who should pay reparations to the people of Afghanistan. But we have noticed this as Afghans, that these people working in D.C. office and people in Pentagon, I think they have they have closed their ears, and they don't actually listen to the people. And democracy, I feel, in the U.S. is serving the rights of individuals, not the majority and groups. So with the groups of Afghans, we have been working so hard now for years, sending the money, resources, some books for the younger people in different areas of Afghanistan to have free access to education and be able to afford a decent life and survive this catastrophic poverty and inequalities in the society.
In just the past 17 years of war, how many people roughly do you think have been displaced from their homes within Afghanistan and emigrated to other countries outside of Afghanistan?
The last year when I traveled in Afghanistan, there was a number of a million internal displaced refugees inside Afghanistan, and I'm not updated about the statistics of refugees today, because I feel that there are more internal refugees than there were in Kabul and the neighboring now countries like Pakistan and Iran, and I think that the last offensive attacks of Taliban in central part of Afghanistan back on 7th November 2018 is a good example. It displaced more than, like a village of more than 600,000 people. And a lot of, and I think 100,000 of them were displaced to Kabul. And then another big portion of them were, they moved to Bamyan and also some other places that were safe from Taliban hands. And there were, and surprisingly, there wasn't any adequate actions taken by the Afghanistan government because it's so fragile. And I now think that Afghanistan is actually sold out to superpowers and fighting a proxy war with no agenda for state building.
When I hear the word village, I think of something very small, but 600,000 people is a large city. I mean, that is that's something I would think of as a big population center.
Sorry. Thank you for correcting me, David. That's actually a province. So that was Mali, Stony Khos, and to be accurate, the attack in Ghazni.
Yeah. I wonder what you think when you read a U.S. newspaper or watch U.S. news. When there are discussions of the war on Afghanistan, which there are not enough, that there seems to constantly be the idea that if the United States were to end the war on Afghanistan, things for the people of Afghanistan would get even worse. And of course, if Donald Trump were to end the war on Afghanistan, that would be far worse than if a Democratic president were to end the war on Afghanistan. I mean, the Democrats in Washington cheered when President Obama pretended to end the war in Afghanistan and are outraged that Donald Trump has suggested he might de-escalate the war in Afghanistan. What, as an Afghan, what do you think? Should the war be ended or not?
Oh, well, David, who doesn't want a country with a war or a peaceful place to grow up? I think with the current negotiation that's going on with the Taliban, the world, U.S., NATO coalition are repeating their mistake again and again, because it's the country named Afghanistan, and I feel it would be a difficult case now U.S. Trying to bring peace in Afghanistan with negotiating with the Taliban, and Taliban who are, and back, I guess, in time, the Taliban pretty much were harbored by the U.S. machine guns. And I feel that instead of deceiving with the public and manipulating that there will be a sustained peace coming for Afghanistan, they should focus more on involving Afghans, the religious leaders, the other minor and major groups in Afghanistan who are excluded from these negotiations, including the government. And Afghans should talk about the future of their country. And I feel that since U.S., like anytime or anywhere that U.S. has been involved, like nothing has been peaceful. Like when the Versailles Treaty back after the end of First World War. And then I feel that with everything that's going on in Afghanistan, it's going to be another failure. And of course, that it won't be easy for Pentagon, for NATO, and NATO officials to witness loose in Afghanistan.
Yes, they don't like to admit every time they lose a war, and so they just don't end the wars. But it's interesting you mentioned NATO. NATO is planning to have a meeting in Washington on April 4th, and you, Hor Arifi, have been kind enough to say that you will come and speak at the events. We're planning to say no to NATO and yes to peace. People can go and see what's happening at notonato.org. In the United States, a lot of people seem to believe, at least at the moment, at least with the current partisan configuration in the government, that if a war is a NATO war, then it's a better war. It's a more legal and acceptable and humanitarian mm-hmm. war than if it's just a U.S. war by itself. What do you make of that notion, and what good or bad NATO has done for Afghanistan?
David, first, I would highly encourage a lot of people who are listening to this radio show to read your book. So first, they can at least make some sense why these wars are going, or why these wars are like that exist. I think it's something that we should reflect back in history, and we should learn. So, like back in 1941, so like why there were plans for a new office building for the military, like which came to be known as the Pentagon, and were brought before the Senate on August 14, 1941. And Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan was so puzzled, and he said that unless the war is to be permanent, why must we have permanent accommodations for war facilities of such size? And I think quoting this from a senator back in 1941, and reading through history, like none of the wars made or they're making plans for wars. Like, it's not justified. It's not humanitarian. Wars can solve nothing, but it devastates and it breaks the relationship, and it brings more devastation in the country, and pretty much all wars on opium. It brought more opium and poppies. It went inside the U.S., the war on poverty. It couldn't eradicate poverty, and it increased inequalities and more poverty. Indeed, it is true, David. I feel that there are more houses than people in the U.S., but why where is this house? Why U.S., a country with a large population in the world, why it has more than, I guess, it's about 565,000 people, like homeless, living day and night on the East Street. And I don't think if anyone would be able to make some sense of her, because me now, being from Afghanistan and reading not only my country history, but all this history, I'm not able to justify any war that's made, and I can't make a bad sense of war. A war is just killing your humanity, and inside and outside, and it cannot be answered.
Can you imagine what the United States and NATO members might have done for Afghanistan if they had given Afghanistan money and support for houses and schools and clean energy and agriculture and useful human and environmental projects rather than the past 17 years of war?
Things would have been upside down now if the entire NATO coalition and U.S. at 156 countries was not extensively interfering with Afghanistan. I think that if the world had given these resources rather than spending it on wars, on their compounds, military, it would have rebuild the country, Afghanistan, and we could see an Afghanistan during 1975, and a country which was even maybe similar and equal to a country in Europe. But I mean, that wasn't the plan, and nothing happened. So even all this money sent to Afghanistan, it actually didn't get to hands of the needy people, and it brought an increased more corruption in the country, and it brought more poverty and suffering on the people imposed. And there are a lot of reports, maybe with the election 2009 in Afghanistan, and reading Ambassador Peter Galbraith's articles on the status of vast corruption in the election, I feel that for years and years now, for 18 years, the world, U.S., Pentagon, NATO, they are supporting a fresh election and a corrupt government that was brought through U.S. agenda in Afghanistan after 2001.
Well, I hope that enough years have gone by and enough pressure can be brought from around the world and from within the United States to change things. Hor Arifi, I'm very glad that you will be joining us and speaking at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace Festival in Washington, D.C. in April. Again, people can go to notonato.org. We will also have that link up at talknationradio.org. We've been speaking with Hor Arifi, who is an Afghan activist, has been involved with humanitarian works, has worked as a coordinator of the Afghan Peace Volunteers, is working with Afghan diaspora communities, helping people at home in Afghanistan, here in the United States and elsewhere. Hor Arifi, thank you for what you're doing and for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
And thank you so much, David Swanson, for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, boycotts are not only a constitutionally protected form of speech, they are a social tool with which citizens, often reduced to their role as consumers, try to use that role to reflect their values about the treatment of farm workers or an apartheid government. That speech and that tool are under attack right now, but not in general. Current moves in Congress and some states only concern themselves with penalizing boycotts aimed at territories illegally occupied by Israel. We'll hear about so-called anti-BDS laws and their context from Josh Rubner, policy director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Also on the program, people should be free to walk down the street without being watched by the government. It sounds uncontroversial in a society with aspirations toward democracy, but that precept is not at all a given in 2019 America, where a company like Google or Amazon has the capacity, a growing capacity, to track people in public space and to identify them using facial recognition technology. How will they use these powerful surveillance tools? Amazon's early move was to meet with ICE officials to market the tools to them. We'll talk about the concerns and the pushback to face surveillance with Shankar Narayan, director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the ACLU of Washington State. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The New York Times doesn't say exactly what's in the provision Senate Republicans added to legislation on Middle East security policy, only that it, quote, aims to curtail support for the boycott, divest, and sanctions, or BDS movement, which seeks to pressure Israel into ending the occupation of the West Bank, close quote. The January 28th piece says a good deal, though, in its positive framing. Senate advances pro-Israel bill, says the headline, and the lead describes rules, quote, affirming the right of local and state governments to break ties with companies that boycott or divest from Israel, close quote. It is a beltway story about GOP efforts to seed divisions among Democrats and tells readers that Republicans are becoming more brash in their accusations for which it proceeds to make space, including that of a North Dakota senator who, we're told, mused on Twitter that Democratic opposition to the anti-BDS measure, quote, may be nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to hide the rising anti-Semitism in their own party, close quote. The piece positions Marco Rubio, who pushed for the provision as representing one side of the issue, citing his statement that the BDS movement, quote, isn't about freedom and equality, it's about destroying Israel, close quote. But the Times seems not to see how its own use of the terms pro-Israel and anti-BDS as synonyms rather suggests the same view, all of which encourages one to try looking at things under a different light. We're joined now by Josh Rubner. He's policy director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights and author of, most recently, Israel, Democracy or Apartheid State, from Olive Branch Press. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Josh Rubner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Like so much coverage, that New York Times piece really takes as its topic political maneuvering. And in that context, the comeback, if you will, to what the story calls Republican efforts to paint some Democrats as extremist and even anti-Semitic, the comeback is to have a quote from Senator Chris Murphy telling Rubio, You know it isn't true that a significant number of Senate Dems support BDS, which again, as text, tells us that not supporting BDS means not being anti-Semitic. So it's partly down to the political football approach, but the effect is the same. There is no positive explication or defense of the BDS movement to be found in a news account ostensibly about that movement. So with that off my chest, we spoke with you 2 years ago, July, about an Israel anti-boycott act. Is this that again? What should we know about this Senate iteration?
No, this is a different bill that was also introduced in the previous Congress and the one before that, and it's called the Combating BDS Act. And the reason why Marco Rubio has been unsuccessful for the past 4 years in trying to enact this bill into law is because it's patently unconstitutional. It's a bill that encourages states to penalize individuals for their political and moral and religious beliefs on boycotting for Palestinian rights by denying those people governmental contracts. And we've had two federal district judges already overturn these laws in Kansas and Arizona, thanks to lawsuits brought by the ACLU. And there are three pending lawsuits challenging similar laws in Texas and Maryland as well. And the reason why Senator Rubio is attaching this very controversial bill to this broader bill is because he knows he can't pass it as a standalone bill because of its unconstitutionality. So he's trying to hide it within a broader bill.
So who is this aimed at? Is it governments? Is it businesses? Who would be affected by this?
This is a bill that attempts to encourage states to coerce individuals and companies to toe a particular line regarding Israel and the Palestinians, and to punish individuals and companies that support Palestinian rights through nonviolent efforts to engage in campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And it's a patently unconstitutional call because what it's doing is it's trying to leverage the power of government to punish people for having a certain political viewpoint. And it should be noted that the Supreme Court of the United States has upheld that engaging in political boycotts, whether the government agrees with them or not, is a constitutionally protected right under the First Amendment.
Well, it sounds as though legislatively this may have no legs, but it's clearly about something more than that. I have to return to this troubling sentence, also from the New York Times. Quote, "With Britain's Labour Party embracing anti-Israel policies and other left-wing parties in Europe courting Muslim immigrant voters, Jews in the United States have eyed the toehold that Palestinian rights activists have secured in the Democratic Party with trepidation." Close quote. There's a lot happening there. You could engage what strikes you, but what bums me out is the crude zero-sum presentation of Muslims against Jews, against Palestinians. It seems like politics without people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's presumptuous of the New York Times to assume a certain political viewpoint because of someone's religious affiliation. And I would go even further to say that that's even bigoted to consider that a particular group would hold a political ideology just based on their identity. It's very clear that the movement for Palestinian rights in the United States is comprised of people of all faiths, including people of the Jewish religion, who support boycott, divestment, and sanctions to achieve Palestinian rights. So it's not at all an accurate statement by the New York Times, but what is accurate is the fact that there is more and more support within the Democratic Party, both at the base of the Democratic Party, and now we're starting to see in Congress itself for a new approach to the issue of Israel and the Palestinians. We now have elected members of Congress who not only defend our constitutional right to engage in boycotts for Palestinian rights, but in the case of some freshman members of Congress, like Representative Rashida Tlaib and Representative Ilhan Omar, they actually support boycotts for Palestinian rights. And they're introducing a whole new paradigm for thinking about this issue in the halls of Congress. And this is clearly worrying those who are protecting the status quo of Israeli military occupation and separate and unequal policies toward the Palestinians.
Well, yes, just to further that, reporting does kind of suggest that we see these anti-BDS moves as responsive to the fact that while there is still an ongoing acknowledgement that anti-Semitism, of course, itself is very real and indeed rising, that there seems to be increased understanding that criticism of the policies and practices of the Israeli government is not in itself anti-Semitic, those last being the words of New York Times columnist Michelle Alexander in her recent piece, Time to Break the Silence on Palestine. Having worked around these concerns for years now, do you feel something changing not only in Congress, but just culturally, if you would, around these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's never been a more yawning divide between the parties on this issue, with the Republican Party and its members portraying itself as the party of Israel. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because the policies that are being enacted by the government of Israel mirror the exact ethno-nationalism white supremacy that the Republican Party is pushing out. And that is clearly the ideology and policy of the Trump administration. Whereas the Democratic Party, which is becoming more diverse, more responsive to social justice concerns and campaigns, is naturally gravitating toward Palestinian rights as part and parcel of a broader progressive agenda. So there are huge changes underfoot. I think we're going to see this play out not only in the current Congress, but especially in the upcoming presidential campaign for 2020, where the issue of Israel and the Palestinians dividing Democrats from Republicans has already become a theme in the media.
I guess, finally, I have some concern that the way that corporate media tend to map issues onto Beltway politics can sometimes muddy an issue rather than clarifying it by not separating the ideas, you know, from their vessels, if you will. And if BDS is simply tracked onto new Democrats in Congress, that will not necessarily increase one's understanding of the role that it's playing, you know, on university campuses and on in political organizations outside of two-party politics and, you know, that broader conversation about Israel-Palestine. So I wonder what journalism you think would be helpful in this regard in terms of not just tracking legislation, but tracking the issues themselves.
Yeah, lost in all of this discussion oftentimes is how the movement for Palestinian rights gets reduced to this acronym of BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions are a set of tactics that have been used by numerous social justice movements throughout the history of this country and throughout the world to advance social justice. So to get caught up in the acronym and especially the Republican demonization of BDS as a set of tactics to advance Palestinian rights is really to prevent people from having this broader understanding of just how widespread this movement has become. You've had dozens of college campuses pass resolutions calling for Palestinian rights. You've had more than 10 mainstream church denominations representing tens of millions of Americans calling for boycotting Israeli settlement products, divesting their assets from companies that are complicit in Israel's human rights abuses, and calling for an end to U.S. weapons transfers to Israel, which are, of course, given at taxpayer expense. So this reduction of the movement for Palestinian rights to this BDS acronym is really helping to obfuscate the tremendous amount of support within civil society that's growing for Palestinian rights and how it's become an incredibly mainstream issue.
We've been speaking with Josh Rubner, Policy Director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. They're online at uscpr.org. His book, Israel, Democracy or Apartheid State, is out now from Olive Branch Press. Thank you, Josh Rubner, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
From the War Resisters League to the Government Accountability Project, Data for Black Lives and 18 Million Rising, from Families Belong Together to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, more than 85 groups signed letters to corporate giants Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, demanding that the companies commit not to sell face surveillance technology to the government. The coalition cites not the mere potential for such technology to be used to target vulnerable communities, particularly communities of color, but the history of technology being turned to that purpose. Media coverage of technological developments often conveys an air of inevitability. Tools once created must be used, and businesses exist to make money from them. How do we center the public good in decision-making around technology that some call a perpetual lineup? Shankar Narayan is director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the ACLU of Washington, Seattle. He joins us now by phone from Hawaii. Welcome to Counterspin, Shankar Narayan.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, USA Today last summer had a story that read, quote, "Police said they were able to identify the suspected killer in Maryland's Capital Gazette shooting using facial identification technology, an increasingly popular tool for law enforcement that's been embroiled in controversy as civil libertarians warn about the risks of misuse," close quote. In the Seattle Times, it was, quote, "When the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Oregon started using Amazon's facial recognition software in 2016, deputies welcomed a new tool to quickly identify suspects and solve cases. The American Civil Liberties Union saw something different, a troubling extension of the government's ability to keep an eye on its citizens," close quote. So the setup is, there's a tool, it's very useful in crime fighting, but you might worry it could potentially be misused if you're one of those people who doesn't trust law enforcement. The coalition letter that the ACLU was part of says, number one, we're not just talking about civil libertarians, and two, we aren't only talking about potential misuse. Could you outline for listeners the concerns that this coalition is representing and what's happening now that drives those concerns?
I think that that is a great lead-in. There is a long history of surveillance tools being adopted under the rubric of exactly the same kind of public safety concerns that you talked about. I think it's often the lead-in to the widespread adoption of a technology that it's going to help catch someone in one of the worst possible situations. But of course, I think it's important to tie this back to the long history of use of surveillance technologies that will particularly impact vulnerable communities. And those are the groups that make up this coalition, groups such as immigrants, communities of color, religious minorities, even domestic violence and sexual assault survivors. All of those are represented here. And I think their point is that it's not what could go wrong, it's what has gone wrong when surveillance technologies have been used in the past, because they have had such a disproportionate effect on those very communities. So the entire history of the 20th century has been one of use of the surveillance tools of the day. One example is the civil rights movement, where virtually every major civil rights leader had a dossier on them in government hands that was fed by infiltration. It was fed by bugging, simply following people around. They even had their version of fake news, where the government would fake a letter from one activist to the other with the stated goal of trying to drive them apart from each other and weaken the movement. You know, that's far from the only example. Even prior to that, the Japanese incarceration, another great example, where we have activists in Seattle who have talked to incarceration survivors who talked about how, in fact, the incarceration itself was illegal and unconstitutional, as the Supreme Court later declared. But the existence of those safeguards didn't stop the infrastructure from being misused. There was a technological back end that included a registration system so that when the order was given to incarcerate Japanese people in our area, they knew exactly where to find those people and send them to the incarceration camps. A powerful quote that I heard from one of our activists was, "I was a loyal American, but I couldn't do anything about the incarceration because my crime was my face." And I think that should be particularly chilling, given that we now see face surveillance, this potentially game-changing technology that can make its way into government hands without checks and without even this prior discussion of how the tool will be used. And I'd like to say as well that, you know, lest we think that this is all in the past, even since 9/11, for example, the Muslim community in New York City was surveilled using license plate readers and other technologies without suspicion and without warrant in an operation that failed to net a single terrorist. Tools like social media monitoring have been used against Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street. So, you know, we see the echoes of the past and how these technologies are being used today. And that's why we should be particularly concerned given the power of facial recognition.
Well, one of the concerns that crops up in what coverage we do see has to do with just the quality of the technology. You know, we may hear that it's not especially good, this facial recognition technology, particularly at recognizing black faces and brown faces. But I have also heard that perhaps we want to be careful about making this racial bias in the technology the crux of our opposition because, for example, the Chinese state facial recognition system had that problem and their response was to buy a driver's license database from an African state and then, you know, improve the ability of the data to, in fact, recognize black and brown faces. But we're not really calling essentially for the tool to be better. That's not really the goal precisely, is it?
No, it is absolutely not. And I think I should make clear that facial recognition or face surveillance is a uniquely dangerous technology that we believe should not be sold to the government. Even a perfectly functioning, unbiased facial recognition system is extremely dangerous. That's because this technology gives the government unprecedented power to track people, surveil who they are, where they go, and who they know across geographies, across time. You don't have to drive your car if you want to avoid license plate readers. You don't have to bring your cell phone if you don't want it to be tracked. But you can't leave your face at home, and your face print is exactly the target for these products like Amazon's recognition, Microsoft's face, that make widespread use of facial recognition technology easy and cheap. And so that's really the game changer we're talking about. In addition to that, the government doesn't have to decide ahead of time who it's going to follow around because face surveillance is silent, it's undetectable, and it can be applied after the fact to any video or still image. And we know, of course, that there's more and more video and still imaging such that anything you do in a public space may well get recorded and then be subject to facial recognition if the government has that tool in its toolbox. And we also know that black and brown communities are already over-policed. They are already subject to a disproportionate amount of video and other surveillance. So one might expect that facial recognition in government hands will layer on top of that. Again, even if it's perfectly functioning, this is a technology that can be used on footage from officer body cameras, from video cameras, from drones, from private surveillance, and it's easy and cheap to add to that infrastructure. So all of these concerns are before you even get to talking about the bias within the technology itself, which seems consistently demonstrated by a number of studies. I think it's difficult to buy Amazon's rebuttals to critique these studies where they say, well, you used the wrong confidence interval, or you didn't use the tool the right way,
right,
or we made improvements in November, and so, you know, you should have used the tool after that. You know, all of those, I think, start to sound a little bit tone deaf when you look at the broader trend of study after study showing that this tool is less accurate at identifying people of color. It's particularly bad at identifying women of color. And in addition to that, you know, we want to also add in the layer of what's called affect recognition. In other words, the use of these tools, not just to identify people, but to determine whether they're happy or sad, maybe whether they're angry, determine their level of dangerousness.
Wow.
There are, in fact, companies out there that purport to determine whether someone has a propensity to be a terrorist simply by analyzing their face print. And imagine, you know, an officer making a life or death decision based on a facial recognition analysis from their body camera that is biased in a way that shows a black person, for example, to be more angry and dangerous than they actually are. And exactly that kind of bias has been found when using these tools. So bias is an additional layer, you know, on top of all of the concerns in building this infrastructure that we have yet to discuss, simply because agencies are already acquiring these tools really without public notice and without transparency.
Well, finally, and it sounds like you're heading towards it, but I have seen stories on, for instance, how San Francisco might become the first U.S. city to forbid its agencies from using facial recognition technology. And I've seen opinion columns that warn about some of the dangers and concerns that we've talked about here. But I would say that I do feel that overall there's not a sense of urgency from the press corps. Media have a kind of, well, it's out of the box now, let's see what it does vibe. You know, there's a sense that it's just not plausible somehow to say don't, you know, to say no to the use of a technology. And I see that matched to some degree in the public, you know, oh, I just assume everything I do is on camera. And that makes me worried as well. What finally would a press corps vitally engaged in protecting our civil rights be doing? What kind of reporting would you like to see?
A really great question. And I think it connects to a much broader situation. These large technology vendors have assured us that technology is a neutral thing that's going to come in and solve the problems we have around public safety. But of course, you know, I think the job of a responsible media would be to question those assumptions and ask about a narrative in which we as communities, and particularly the most impacted communities, are able to come together and set a values framework within which technology acts. I think as a society, our entire country is founded on this idea of civil liberties, right? That's what our constitution is. And technologies like face surveillance should not be allowed to end run around those values without a real public discussion.
We've been speaking with Shankar Narayan, director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the ACLU of Washington, Seattle. Shankar Narayan, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. I appreciate being on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
When climate change hits the fragile just-in-time grocery system, where will your food come from? How long can you eat? You probably have house insurance or renter's insurance and car insurance, so why don't you have food insurance? Our next guest has helped Americans prepare with emergency food stocks for almost 30 years. He's a homesteader, a wise blogger at survivalacres.com and now at foodassets.com. From somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, Jonathan Richards, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning, and thank you, Alex.
So what does it mean to be a prepper?
Well, prepping is kind of a way of life, of just doing basic essential preparations to make sure that you have some resiliency in your home and for your family. It doesn't require a great deal of money or time if you do it wisely and carefully. One of the things that I've been involved with is with food preparations and having food set aside for storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, disasters. Anything like that is a pretty smart idea. Americans used to prep and have their food preps on hand for quite a long time, but that kind of changed when we moved to supermarkets in this country. And the supermarket made it so easy and convenient for people to just run down to the store and buy the food that they need. However, when there's been a disaster, the supermarket shelves get wiped out pretty quickly, sometimes in just a matter of hours. So having something on hand is always a good idea, and you can do that by stocking up your pantry.
Yes, we live in a rural area, and so if we do go to a city at all, we really stock up, and then we joke that our store is in our basement. We go down to the store downstairs and bring things up from there. But, you know, in these times, there are a lot of people in cities who seldom cook. They're relying on fast food and restaurants, and apparently tens of millions of real Americans could barely afford food, much less stocking up. They're just looking for the next meal for their kids. So, Jonathan, I'm wondering, is prepping just for the middle and upper class people?
Well, actually, I don't think the middle and upper class are doing much prepping anymore. It's almost always been the lower class people that have struggled to pay their bills. For some reason, they seem to be a little bit more aware of the need to be prepared. Maybe it's because they don't have the money to survive disasters, so they set things aside. They get tuned into the whole issue of being prepared a little more readily than the middle and upper class. And I base that all upon all these decades of being involved in this industry. We've seen a dramatic decline in the ability for people to buy and prepare with food preparations. And I've been in touch with canneries and different suppliers around the country, and they've seen the same thing. So I think it's actually the lower classes, the people that are having less money, less ability to have a disposable income, that have been making preparations over the years. There are some of the upper middle classes that are doing it, but it's nowhere near what some of the hype and propaganda that you may have seen published.
Later, I want to get to the big picture reasons why our listeners may want to collect a basic stock of food and water, but for those in a rush, what are the most popular options to get started on a food insurance policy?
I would always recommend buy what you eat. It's been kind of the mantra that I've been speaking about for decades. Don't buy strange foods. Don't fall for different advertising campaigns that try to convince you that you need this or you need that. Buy what you actually eat. That's always the best and smartest move, because if you won't eat it, it doesn't do you any good, and you wind up wasting some of your money. But the other thing is you can buy your staples. Staples come in bulk quantities. They're fairly inexpensive. They last a long time. You can get upwards of 30 years out of some of these staples, and you can prepare them relatively easily, and they go really far. So you can take out just a little bit that you need, prepare a meal from it, and store the rest away, even for decades. So the staples that I recommend are things like pastas, rice, potatoes, some grains that you like to eat. my wife and I, we always eat oat groats almost every single day. It's healthy for us, especially at my age. And they're not that expensive to purchase. And we doll them up, you know, with blueberries and pumpkin seeds and things like that, you know, to make them a little bit more delicious. But if you buy your staples and you learn to prepare these foods and use them on a daily basis, then you'll have never wasted any of your money.
And how much food does it really take per person to stay alive beyond the 3 days supply the American government usually recommends? Do we need a basement to put it in? Can we get it in a closet? I mean, what sort of mass are we talking about here?
Well, if you're buying the type of food that I'm speaking of, which is dehydrated food, it's very compact and nutritionally dense, so it doesn't take up a huge amount of space. Even a one-year food supply will fit into a very small closet of about 6 feet tall and about 2 feet wide. And you can actually get a one-person, one-year food supply from dehydrated food lines that will fit into that space. But if you want to get like a three-month or, say, six-month food supply, you know, you could put that into your pantry really easily or even under your bed. It'll store without refrigeration, and the amount of space required is actually minimal.
10 years ago, when the world financial crisis shook the faith in the system, I put away a year's worth of wheat and rice, among other things. And the hard, unprocessed wheat berries can last decades or more, maybe even centuries, if stored properly, as the Egyptians did. But the rice I'm not so sure about. So next month, as I told you, I'm going to crack up one of my buckets of rice. It's sealed airtight in a Mylar bag, and I packed it with oxygen depletion sacks. Jonathan, do you expect that rice will still be edible now, 10 years later?
Actually, I do. White rice can have a shelf life of 30 years. And so it depends on how you packaged it and whether it was kept in a cool, dark location and if it was actually airtight. But it does sound like you did do that. So you should be able to expect it, be able to open that rice and eat it. I wouldn't expect there to be any issues. I myself have had open containers that would be both buckets and cans. That's the number 10 cans that I've eaten out of for decades. They've been opened and used little by little by little because I can't eat, you know, that much at one time. I simply take out what I want and put the lid back on and forget about it. But it's not, you know, the humidity in this area is not real bad. I'm not too far from you, so I would expect you to have the same type of performance.
Yes, it's down in a cold basement, but it never freezes, and of course it never sees the light. I do like rice and canned seafood because in an emergency, both can be eaten without cooking. You just soak the rice overnight to get a mealy but nutritious food. I guess there are a lot of foods like that. If we didn't, say, have electricity for our electric stove, we still need to eat it somehow.
Yeah, most dehydrated food requires preparation and cooking, but it's actually relatively simple to do. I advocated using pressure cookers for years to cut down the cooking time, the preparation time. But there are other techniques. There's things called an instant pot available now that can reduce the cooking time quite dramatically. You can prepare a meal in about 30 minutes with that. The other things you can do is to soak the dehydrated food in the water and let that sit. Or you can even do what's called thermos cooking. You can take hot water and add that to a thermos, then add in your dehydrated foods and just let it sit, and it'll cook by itself. So, you know, it's almost a hands-free operation.
And we know the Mormon Church used to require believers to stock up to 3 years' worth of food. They've since cut that back. And I learned a lot by watching YouTube videos with Mormon women showing how they did it, and I recommend that to anybody who's interested in food storage. Jonathan, talk to us about the role of religion and preparing emergency food stocks.
Well, the Mormon Church does have that doctrine, and I've been aware of that for some time, and I think that they've changed that now to about a one-year food supply, but I'm not sure. I'm not a member, but I suppose it's probably been reduced since then. For the most part, religion has always played a role in people being prepared because that has actually been where most of the customers wind up coming from. They're from one church or another, one group or from another. And sometimes from some businesses, and they want to get their employees properly prepared. But we have, in fact, seen a big surge in customers over the many years that were buying food from religious organizations. However, we've also been in contact with FEMA and other organizations that have been preparing hospitals and state agencies to get the people in their areas properly prepared. And oftentimes they'll come to us even asking for advice. So it's not just religion that has a role in being prepared. It's something that everybody should do, every American, every Canadian. You really don't want to always be 100% dependent upon the supermarkets. And unfortunately, that's the reality. We live in a situation where if the supermarkets empty out, we're in trouble. And we need to do something about that.
What would you say are the biggest prepper mistakes?
Well, that's a big list. Unfortunately, I think a lot of preppers don't buy what they actually eat. That's one of the big issues that I think that they run into. They purchase foods that sound good, and they never try them out, so they never get the experience of actually eating that food. They also don't do enough research. If you don't research what you're actually going to be purchasing, and I don't care where you get that from, you may not be getting the nutrition and the calories that you actually require, because you know there's a big difference between a sedentary lifestyle and an active lifestyle. If we really were in a collapse situation or a crisis situation where there was something big and bad that had happened, you know, you're not going to be able to just sit around. You're going to be active in doing things, you know, looking out for yourself, looking out for your family, maybe cleaning up from storm debris, that sort of thing. So you've got to have enough nutrition on hand, and that's probably a big area that people need to really think about.
And you have a section on your blog about food scams that people who want to get prepared food should watch out for. Can you tell us about one or two?
Yes, I can. I won't mention any names, but one of the things that I've seen with the food scams is the misrepresentation on the food kit sizes. Usually they're nutritionally deficient and they won't last anywhere near the advertised claims. Perhaps the ad will say something like this is a one-year food supply. But when you calculate out the actual nutrition using their own published figures, you'll discover that it can be extremely poorly represented. It may only last 3 months. And so you would actually require like 3 or 4 of those same units, which makes them extremely expensive if you were to purchase that and assume it was going to last for a whole year. That's probably one of the bigger scams that we see.
And how would you characterize the state of the prepper industry? I mean, are things flourishing? Are things getting neglected? What's going on?
Actually, I believe that the prepper industry has been seriously co-opted, and it's actually in a type of collapse in itself right now. There's been a number of companies and even canneries go out of business because there's been so little interest in preparing, or it's because the economic decline is so severe, one or the other. But we've seen a tremendous decline, upwards of 95%. Of people making preparation for the future. The other thing that I've seen is a blending of the prepper meme and the survivalist meme. They used to be separated. The survivalists were actually interested in practical skills and learning to actually live off the land directly, what you might even call primitive living, and practicing that sort of survival techniques. But the prepping meme came into vogue, and a lot of newcomers showed up in the last dozen or so years. And unfortunately, I'll say they polluted the whole effort, and they took everything into who could make the most money, the most profits as quickly as possible. And I think it did a lot of damage. And we're still suffering from that right now because people got really burned out on a lot of the fear-mongering, the paranoia, the xenophobia, and, of course, the profit. Oriented motives that showed up everywhere.
Do you think preppers are more aware of developing climate dangers, or are more climate-aware folks starting to consider deep adaptation options?
I don't think the prepper movement is keenly aware of climate change. There are some, but what I have seen and what I have noticed by visiting some of the forums and blogs is that there's still a lot of derision to climate change. I'm really confused by that because I actually believe that climate change is the number one existential threat to humanity right now. So I don't think the prepper movement has really caught on to the reality of climate change in a big way. What I have seen for those that have are individuals that have taken the time to study the science, to study the published reports, and they will call and ask questions and mention it. But you'd be surprised at how many people still send us emails regarding the whole climate change topic. You know, they're making fun of it, which is really kind of sad because, you know, to step outside and see what's happening, it's real.
Yes, indeed. And we have a lot of scientists on this show who explain why it's happening. On the prepper idea, I wonder if that whole ideal of the brave individual or family surviving while the rest of society collapses, maybe that ideal is actually helping to prop up what is really a dying system. Your thoughts?
Well, we're all embedded within the system. You know, everyone that lives in first world countries particularly, because we are 100% dependent upon the survival of civilization, what we call the system. And we're not as independent as we like to think. In a way, yes, we are propping up the dying system because it is contracting, it is collapsing. I've written tons of articles on that very topic, but we have no choice. We are stuck with one foot in and one foot out. So what we do contributes to ecological collapse by the virtue of us just having to buy the consumer goods to keep us alive. And so we're in a position where we are going to make these contributions whether we like it or not, because we don't have a support system that we can turn to that will sustain us. We can't grow our own food like we think. We can't just quit our jobs and stay home and live on our land and survive. We are committed to being a part of what civilization actually is, and we really don't have a choice about that.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me on the phone is American blogger and survival food expert Jonathan Richards. We're talking about why we all need food insurance. So, of course, there's another side to the prepper coin. We should be prepared to sit out an emergency in our homes and local communities, but as you know, and I know, we should also be prepared to get out quick with a few necessary supplies. Living in the Northwest, we know how fast a wildfire can come over the horizon. How do we prepare to leave?
It depends on what you want to define as leave. If the wildfire situation, like what happened in Paradise or what happened in Redding, California, and even further than that was Santa Rosa, both of these cities burned over rather badly, and people tried to escape, and they had so little warning that many people actually died in the flames, and that was just a horrible tragedy. So leaving when you have a threat like that is definitely going to be important. You need to be prepared with both your car and your emergency supplies on hand and ready to go, but you also need someplace to go to. You and I both live in the Northwest, where there's a tremendous threat of forest fires. I've mapped out several escape routes that could get us away from here into a safe location. But then when you get there, you're going to have your supplies on hand in order to survive while you're there. Now, most people have ideas that they're going to be able to bug out, maybe even go into the woods, given some certain kind of crisis or civil war or something like that. But I've always advocated against that type of thing because it doesn't make any sense. What people need to do is to go for help. That is always the best advice. Always go for help. Go where there are civilization. Go where you can get assistance, where there are food supplies, medical supplies, and help. Otherwise, you're going to put yourself into a refugee situation, and that never turns out very well.
Let me tell a story of how an emergency food cache of mine got tested by accident. When my wife and I purchased our lot in a rural village, we weren't quite ready to move here yet, and there was an ancient mobile home on it. And I ran into a poor guy who was incapacitated with a serious heart problem, and we agreed to let him stay in that old trailer for a few months while he recovered. So I'm going out the door, and I mentioned, hey, there's a 5-gallon bucket of rice in the closet and a stack of flats of soup, 12 cans to a flat. There's vegetable soup and mushroom soup. And that was it. I went back to the city. So he was pretty sick without any real income, and he lived on that for almost 2 months. And afterwards, of course, he said, I'm never going to eat rice again. But
yeah.
My point is, you said to me in an email, we don't always have to wait for the collapse. Sometimes collapse comes to us personally, whether it's losing a job or illness or just old age. What do you think?
Well, I think your story is amazing, actually, that you were willing to help someone like that. I want to congratulate you for doing the right thing. And that's what a lot of people don't seem to realize, that personal collapse is what happens first and foremost, even in a hurricane. It's you that is affected. But even if it's not you, it can be somebody else, and that person may need some help. And you may not have the money or even, say, the fuel or even the time to assist them, but if you can hand them something to eat and get them through another day, you've done a great good. So when personal collapse happens, if you've got supplies set aside, you know, if you've got the means in order to take care of yourself or even someone else or to share what you have as the need arises, you've done the right thing. But by not doing that, by not making preparations, then everyone is more and more reliant upon the external system to keep them alive. And if they don't have immediate access to it, then people suffer. And you can prevent that by being prepared.
Right. It amazes me that some people who are very worried about authoritarian government, whether they're on the left or the right, you know, libertarian, whatever, don't think about their total dependence for the next day's meals on that same system. And so I think part of freedom is to be able to grow at least some of your own food and to store some of your food so that you're not totally connected to every authoritarian move that comes along.
That's definitely true. But, you know, freedom comes at a price in reality. If you want freedom, then you have to maintain a very high level of independence. Regarding growing your own food, it's an enormous amount of work. I built a commercial greenhouse and a large garden space here with automatic watering systems, and I swiftly discovered just how difficult it really was, especially up here with our short growing season, to grow sufficient numbers of calories. What ends up happening is I have a short growing season. Despite having the greenhouse, I get this huge harvest that I have to immediately process as fast as I possibly can. And either I can it, I pickle it, I dry it, I do something with it, and I eat a lot of it. But the reality is I cannot grow all my own food. I can't even get close to it. I'm not even growing 25% of it, not in reality.
I know what you're talking about. I tried to do the same thing in almost northern Ontario back in the 80s, and we did have 40 acres cleared. I had a tractor. I tried really hard, but there was no way that we were growing more than, well, like you say, about 25% of our food. So it's difficult even when you're young and able, and harder as you get older. And I think to a degree there is a new topic that's going to come up as the boomers age, and that is almost prepping for age. I mean, it's very much like a system collapse as your body starts to be able to do less. You have less energy. Maybe you have less brain power to cope with things. And so I'm wondering if there's a way that we can prepare for that.
Well, you can and you can't, unfortunately, because as you have reduced capabilities as you age, and that's just a fact of life, you become more and more dependent upon facility and services and assistance. What you can do is make preparations for the basics and the essentials, you know, which is the same thing you would do if you were younger. But being in a community where you can have help is going to be of the utmost importance. Making sure that you're always going to have access to critical supplies like water and heat. Up here in the Northwest, our winters can be pretty brutal. The summers are not real bad if you can get a little bit of shade during the hottest part of the year. But in the wintertime, without heat, you will freeze to death. So you want to make sure that you have access to those essentials no matter what age you really are. But as a senior citizen, it's something that I've been thinking about as I'm slowly approaching, I'm in middle age right now, but I'm slowly approaching that senior citizen timeline. And I'm going to reduce my footprint so I have less to maintain, less to take care of. And I'm going to surround myself by family members that can also keep an eye out for me.
So do you think we would realize if our system is collapsing, if it happened in a kind of a slow motion things falling apart? Well, heck, part of the U.S. government is shut down as we talk right now, and there's all sorts of people who are working three jobs, barely having a life. But would we know if it's really collapsing?
It's collapsing right now. It's in contraction right now. We're geared to see opportunity, but not systemic problems. And there's been a number of studies that have pointed this out. So, you know, we are not in a suitable mindset as humans to understand how collapse actually works. We have a lot of cognitive dissonance that takes place within us in regards to the things that we believe and the things that are actually true. We have systemic risk. We've got geographical risk. We've got vector risk, density risk. these are factors that are occurring right now by the way that we designed and built civilization and how it's currently collapsing. Economically speaking, as you say, you know, there's a lot of homeless people. There's a lot of people that are really suffering, that are having to work multiple jobs. That's collapse. That's collapse right there on that front alone. If you followed my blog at all, I spend a great deal of time documenting the climate collapse issues that are happening all over the world. That's indeed happening, and it's going to accelerate faster and faster.
Yeah, like the extreme hitting Australia right now, that just blew my mind because they've had very hot years already and now setting new records. I just almost don't know what to think about what's going on there.
It's unbelievable. I used to have contact with some Australians regarding what they could do to be prepared, and I did definitely warn them about the issue of heat and extreme brush fires. I can't even imagine how they could survive in a situation like that if the grid goes down. That's going to be almost catastrophic for some of those people.
Well, mind you, that's true of the whole American South. I mean, we interviewed an author about 6 years ago who wrote about the reason that the whole movement to the Sun Belt at that time worked was due to air conditioning, and take away air conditioning and there would be another movement back north again.
There will be. Climate change poses an existential threat to humanity. I have written several critical articles on this topic, and the entire Southwest poses to be uninhabitable as things continue to warm up. And, of course, if the grid were to go down, that would make things that much worse that much quicker. But the real issue is going to be water supplies and wet bulb temperatures. Water supplies are declining in aquifers all over the country right now. I'm not sure what's happening up in Canada with the water supply, but you might be okay for a time. But here in the Southwest, we have a water issue. They're constantly fighting over the Colorado River and who's going to get what allotments, and now they're being told that some farmers aren't going to get anything at all. I don't know how long that's going to last. It all has to do with rainfall and snowpack, but that's been in massive decline year after year. So the issue for large segments of the lower southern United States is going to be, where are they going to go? And on top of that, we have accelerated melt at Greenland, Antarctica, and in the Arctic. We're going to see sea level rise that is going to inundate the coastlines and flood out many cities all over the world. This is going to create a gigantic refugee problem. We haven't seen anything yet. It's just going to get significantly worse.
Where do people find your past blog entries?
Well, it's survivalacres.com/blog. And on the right side of the blog, there is a navigation menu for some of the current articles. There's a tag cloud, or you can pick on a particular topic, find all the articles related to that topic. There's over 3,000 posts on the blog, and I've been cleaning it up a little bit, so I think you'll find about 2,700 of them up there still right now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Jonathan Richards, an old hand in the food prepper game and another witness to our race towards collapse. So I want to talk just for a minute about food reserves and national security. We know there's no big warehouses in the cities anymore. It's all in trucks rolling down the highways, the just-in-time system. And I don't think the public really is aware of how dangerous and risky that strategy is. What happens if those food trucks stop for any reason, Jonathan?
We starve. And then we immediately devolve into chaos. It is the just-in-time system. And it's been said within the industry that we are one food harvest away from collapse. Because we can transport food and ship goods all around the world right now, we can share our food supplies with countries in need, and that would include us if our harvest were to fail. However, what happens when that harvest starts to fail all over the world? And we know that's going to happen as climate change exacerbates the situation. But if we were to have a food harvest failure or a trucking failure of any kind, the supermarkets are cleaned out in a matter of hours. It wouldn't be 3 days before we would actually see empty supermarkets all over the nation. And then people would be fighting over the basics. And water and food is going to be one of the first priorities for most people, and then medical supplies after that.
Well, now get this. The United States has a strategic petroleum reserve, but I was shocked to learn the American Grain Reserve System, set up by Franklin Roosevelt, was abolished by the 1996 Freedom to Farm Act. So Americans do not have a national grain reserve. Even the ancient Egyptians knew to store grains against a bad harvest. So I don't understand how Americans feel that they are immune to starvation.
I think it has to do with our way of life, you know, that so-called non-negotiable way of life. You know, we live a very privileged life in this country because we have easy access to pretty much anything that we might want. If you can pay for it, you can have it. And we've got convenience stores and supermarkets almost on every corner. So food has never been the priority that it once was. But back during the Great Depression, people quickly realized, you know, that having food was a very serious issue. Nowadays, people are accustomed to going to the supermarket and buying whatever they need, or even going out. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, they don't even cook anymore. This sets up an incredible dependency that if there's any failure in the system to provide food to people within cities, villages, and towns all over this country, all over Canada, all throughout the world, what are they going to do? And this is why having food on hand is just a smart idea. You can stay home. You can stay out of the chaos. You can stay out of the rioting. You can stay out of the conflicts that could occur when people start fighting over basic essentials like food or even water.
In contrast to America, half of all world grain reserve stocks are held in China. China began a buying spree around 2013, according to my research, as part of their national security plan. And so when we hear the world has enough grain to last just over 2 months, and that was a UN statistic back from 2012, we have to remember that 99% of my listeners will be shut out from half of those grain reserves. There's no way China's going to be sending it over to America, I don't think. So we really only have about 1 month ready in case volcanoes blow and cause a global cooling, or a meteorite arrives, or climate heat wipes out major crops 1 year. That seems so fragile.
It is. We're very short-sighted when it comes to personal preparedness and existential threats like this. Increasing complexity has all kinds of vulnerabilities and trigger points, and the civilization that we have built is incredibly complex. It is very dependent upon the supply of everything from, you know, fuel for the trucks, farmers harvesting and distributing their goods just in time, to supermarkets being able to make that stuff available for human consumption. But it extends far beyond just our food systems. It's everything within our society now has become incredibly interlinked and interdependent. And that is nice for a modern way of life, but it does increase the possibility of something going wrong.
I miss Lester Brown. He was the founder of the World Watch Institute, and then he founded Earth Policy Institute. At age 85, he retired a couple of years ago. He used to make phone calls available for reporters, and I tuned into them on how much grain we have and what we can expect in the coming harvest, what the problems were. Now it's almost impossible to find out how near the edge we are. China keeps its big grain reserves secret. The other big grain trader, like Cargill, it's a very private multinational corporation. Those deals for grains are done in secret. We know how much carbon is in the atmosphere, but it's a big secret how much food we have left. That is just insane to me.
I think food might become the new currency of the future. I've always advocated that food was much more important than things like gold or silver, because you have to take your gold and silver and exchange it, usually for dollars. And then, in turn, go buy the things that you might need, whether it be fuel for your car or something at the supermarket. You can't take gold and silver into a bank and convert it into cash. You can't take it to a supermarket. You can't take it to a gas station and convert it into the things that you need. So if food supplies become critical anywhere in the world, food will become the new currency, a means of exchange, because we've got 7.7 billion people on this planet. And as you know, they've projected that it's going to go to 9 and then 10 and 11. Well, under climate change, nutritional content of food declines. It doesn't improve. And we've already maximized all of our available growing lands and techniques and methodologies. they are attempting to make more drought-resistant crops. But with increased temperatures, we're going to see a nutritional decline and crop failures. That's pretty much a given. You haven't yet mentioned some of the crop failures that have happened. You know, Mongolia lost huge amounts of cattle and livestock. Russia lost a number of crops. And when this happens, our just-in-time global delivery system is able to generally ship in supplies and prevent massive starvation. But that is yet another point of potential failure. Something that hasn't been brought up yet is we are expected to lose 95% of the world's seaports because of sea level rise. So how are we going to ship this grain around when that happens? This is part of the threat that people haven't really given a lot of consideration to. And unfortunately, I haven't even seen science papers that really target this in the detail that I think that they should.
I haven't seen it either. It's a new point to me, and I'll have to think about that angle. I do know that when the Soviet Union stopped shipping food and oil to Cuba, the Cuban government managed a local food revolution. Even the city of Havana broke out Victory Gardens to start feeding itself. So I'm wondering, maybe Americans or Europeans or Australians could do something similar in a collapse situation.
I've actually read a few studies regarding the Cuba revolution, regarding what they actually went through and how difficult it really was to pull this off. And they had a very fertile climate. Most Americans in particular, and probably most Canadians, do not live in such a climate. And it's actually quite unlikely we could do this. We don't have the land, the space, the resources, the time, sometimes even the water. Seed germination has to occur at a certain specific time, and if you miss that window, you're not going to get a harvest. As I said before, the food that I've grown here, I've discovered that if I was trying to rely upon my own efforts, and I've expended an enormous amount of time trying to raise food here, I would have starved to death. I could not do it, and no one here in my family could have done it either. There might be a few hardy souls around that have more of a dedication than I had available. But I think that in reality that most people will discover that growing their own food, at best, they're going to grow just a small percentage of what they actually consume.
Well, if the system breaks down by degrees and we can get a fraction of what we need from the food system still, say, handed out, maybe what we could grow locally could help us. And certainly what I grow here on my own property is more nutritious, I think, than what's been stored for a month coming out of California or Mexico. So there's still reasons to grow. And, of course, it's good and healthy for our minds to be growing some food.
Oh, well, absolutely. I'm an organic farmer myself, or gardener. And when I do have to buy something from the supermarket, I do the same thing. I buy everything that I possibly can that's organic because I'm concerned about what I'm eating. But I'm only supplementing my actual food supply by what I can grow here. The big issue for nutritionally dense food is going to be the grain crops. And in this area where I live, and in fact everywhere I've ever been, I can't grow sufficient crops. So that becomes a real issue. We are really highly dependent upon the survival of civilization and the industrial agricultural food system to provide the actual nutritional calorie density that we require to maintain the populations that we have. And even if population were to somehow dramatically reduce, you know, it could actually happen through pandemic, massive catastrophe of some sort, you know, war situation, we would have great difficulty still trying to feed the remaining population without industrial agriculture.
When I went out to get my wheat to store, I had a hard time finding any. I called up the supermarkets. Of course, they sell flour. They don't sell unground wheat berries. And I called up another agricultural supplier, and he said, yeah, sure, would you like one boxcar or two? Because that's the volume that they sell at, and I would have liked to just gone up there with a couple of big bags and got whatever leaked out of the boxcar. I eventually found a very small local granary that could sell it to me. And I put it in buckets, but I think, as I told you in email, I put it in kind of the wrong kind of buckets. They're so hard to open, I would need an axe to get these buckets open again. It's not easy starting from the ground up when you don't know what you're doing. Are there particular books or other resources you could recommend for people to get started to educate themselves on this subject?
Well, you know, years ago I used to read a bunch of those books, and I've got a bunch of them in my library. But for personal preparations, there's a number of websites that you would have to find for yourself. I don't have any I can recommend off the top of my head. Sorry about that. But practical preparations is actually not that hard. It's not really much different than buying what you are already buying at the supermarket, except that you're focused more on foods that have a long shelf life and foods that have been properly packaged. There is a Hollywood myth that I'll cover right here that indicates that, you know, the survivors of the apocalypse are going to be consuming food out of abandoned supermarkets, you know, decades later. And that is complete baloney. Most of those foods will have rotted or spoiled. There is a good website called stilltasty.com that will tell you what the shelf life of supermarket food is, and it's 2 to 5 years. After that, it's either spoiled or unfit to eat, or you're definitely at some kind of a risk from either nutritional decline or even really in worst-case scenario, botulism. So most of the food in the supermarkets would have completely disintegrated or gone moldy or gone bad, even the canned food. It doesn't last as long as people seem to think. So stocking up with that sort of stuff, it's fine if you rotate it and eat it frequently. But don't plan on stocking your bunker with a huge supply of canned food and then going down there 12 years later and then expecting to eat it. You probably won't be able to.
Then there's the whole issue of being mentally prepared. You know, people are so out of touch with physical reality. If the grid goes down, iTunes doesn't work, there's going to be a lot of stunned human beings looking around when their phones don't work. So what do you think about mental preparation? Are there things that we could or should be doing?
I think there's a great deal that we need to be doing in this area. There's been some recent studies, and they kind of followed some blog posts that I put up. Americans in particular, and I suppose Canadians may fall into this same group, spend over 7 hours a day staring at a screen. This is an enormous amount of time waste. You know, that's life that you don't get back. You know, just trying to stay abreast of what's going on and following your Twitter feed or your Facebook post or whatever it is that you're looking at. Mental preparation requires you to take responsibility and authority for your own life and that of your own survival. And we take so much of this for granted. You know, we assume the water's going to run from the water tap. We assume that we're going to always be able to stay warm and dry. We assume there's going to be food in the fridge as long as we do X, Y, and Z. And that would be go to work, come home, pay your bills, buy food. Well, that makes you 100% dependent upon the survival of civilization, and that is nothing ever goes wrong. And that's kind of a dangerous way in which to live your life. And when there's been a disaster like a hurricane or a tornado or an ice storm or something that's taken place and has affected large numbers of people, they get a really rude awakening of how unprepared they really were for something to happen. That is that personal collapse that is taking place suddenly in their lives. But if they had taken the time to prepare in advance, to make basic essential preparations, they would have a plan, and they would have the essential supplies that would get them through that period of time.
Right. It's getting through a certain period. I know this with growing crops. For example, if I could get my tomatoes through the frost that usually comes at the 1st of September, I can be harvesting tomatoes right into late October sometimes around here. So I need to be ready to cover up for that one little period. And I think it's the same with the whole food situation, that things may regroup, or they probably will if we have some deep troubles, but you need to get through a week, 2 weeks, maybe a month at least with your own food supplies.
Yes. The biggest issue is nobody knows how long their individual personal collapse is going to take place. You could lose a job and then be out of work literally for several years. And that actually happened to me. And I was able to get through without any trouble because I had a fairly large food supply, and food was never an issue. And even when one of my kids said, "Hey, we're getting hungry," it wasn't any kind of an issue at all. But being prepared for the duration is one thing, but also don't be naive about your preparations. there was a big movement for people to buy garden seeds, you know, that they were able to stock away and put into these number 10 cans, and like, this is going to take care of me when the need arises. But the reality is it takes months for those seeds to come to germinate and to come into harvest where you can harvest the crops. And if something were to go wrong, and in all honesty, it usually does, you don't always get quite the harvest that you think you're going to get, then your planning to eat that harvest could literally go up in smoke. So, you know, you've got to be able to get yourself through any periods of time that might happen to you or to someone that you're trying to help. And I was like, that story you told us about the fellow in that trailer, you know, 2 months, was it enough?
Yeah, well, then after the 2 months, he actually got his government pension. He turned 65. He got some money, and then he got into a old folks' home. And so they started feeding him, and he did survive. That's the happy ending to that story. Jonathan Richards, are you still in the survival food business yourself?
No. No. I wound up stepping back a couple of years ago, and I literally gave the company away. I work there for free, and that's about all I do these days. I maintain the website, and I answer the emails and process the orders. You know, we did an arrangement with the company. I had a major surgery, and they offered to help me pay for my medical bills in exchange for this service that I'm giving them. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened because, as I said, the whole industry has seriously collapsed. So I'm still here, still helping, doing what I can. And primarily these days, I just continue to research and blog about climate change. I've got some projects that I'm working on that I'm trying to promote so that people can be better prepared. I'm kind of a doomer when it comes to this particular topic. I think that we are seriously underestimating the existential threat of what is going to happen to us in regards to climate change.
In your blog resolution for 2019, you said, I want to save the world. Talk to us about that.
Well, it's the truth. I'm a new grandpa. And as a result of that, you know, my perspective of things has changed in ways that I couldn't even fathom before. I'm absolutely terrified for my grandson and the future that he is facing. Of all people, I know a lot about what's unfolding. And that's only because I've spent, you know, literally decades now studying the topic. It doesn't make me an expert. Makes me opinionated about what I think is going to happen. And the young people of the world are becoming more and more aware and even more and more frightened about what future they're going to have. And from what I know about it, they are going to have an incredibly difficult time. I honestly believe that their very survival is at stake. And so one of the projects that I have worked on is called the Life Project, and it is an initiative on a global scale to try to account for reduced human survival. And I do believe that we have issues affecting the future of humanity and the survival of our species that have yet to really come to the forefront. The recent UN report mentioned that we had like 12 years to solve climate change. But I will argue strongly that the solving of climate change may not be possible, that we are going to have to adapt ourselves, if possible, to survive what is coming.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners or to talk about with me?
Well, we've covered most of it, I think. I've got quite a few articles that deal with all of these topics and many, many more available for those who might be interested to read it up on the blog. And that is survivalacres.com/blog. And that's where the primary blog articles are at. I have put up some blog articles up on the Food Assets blog page too, but nowhere near as many. And I'm open to people that want to talk or want to email and ask questions, that sort of thing. I'm trying to help people as much as I possibly can, because I think that we need to really sit up and pay very close attention to what's unfolding now.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Are you a Radio EcoShock listener?
I am. Yep. I've been following you for several years. I mean, I appreciate the opportunity, Alex. This has been great. I haven't allowed any interviews. I was counting the days, and it was 23 years.
You're kidding me.
No. we were reached out to by ABC and CNN and, oh gosh, I can't even remember all of them, but all the big namers had reached out to us during the Mayan calendar run-up and even back during Y2K. I've been in this a long time. And I pretty much just refused all media interviews of any kind. And I wasn't kidding that I made a special exception for you. The anonymity is part of it that I wanted to maintain. Plus, I wasn't really happy with how I've seen other media sources distort the whole concept of people being prepared.
Yeah.
They ridicule it.
I agree. They sensationalize it, but they do it in kind of a snide way that, look at these weird people.
Well, I mean, I'm just like anybody else. You know, I live just like anybody else. You know, I don't have a bunker. I don't have a retreat. I have a homestead. And I carved it out of the forest, literally. And then I put in a road and I built a house and did the greenhouse, the cistern, and the garden and everything else, and all in the root cellar. And that doesn't make me strange. But as time went on, I got away from the whole prepping meme and really started focusing on the whole climate change as the existential risk. And this is why the blog has so much on that topic, because I think it is the number one issue facing humanity now.
Yes.
We can get through almost everything else, but not this. But I don't believe that governmental leaders are going to act decisively. I don't think they're going to do it. They're not going to be allowed to do it. I think that we are more or less going to wind up being on our own. And so ultimately, I'm not looking for what you might call governmental leadership. I think it's going to become a private effort for how are humans going to survive what's coming. But we have to fast forward years into the future. You know, right now, we can go outside, we can breathe the air, we can stand in the sunshine. We're not dying from the heat, we're not starving to death. But fast forward years into the future when wet bulb temperatures are so darn hot that all the plants start dying, then what? You know, that's the future that the grandkids and their kids, if there are any, are going to be facing. And this terrifies me. I don't know if this happened to you, but my grandson is just over a year old. And right after he started to, you know, develop a little bit of his personality, after a couple of months, things really changed for me about how I felt about the future. It's like, I don't want to see humans go extinct, but I think the possibility is fairly high that we will. We need to do something, and because I'm not a defeatist. I absolutely do not believe in just giving up. I think we need to do everything we can, and so shows like yours are really critically important. We've got to keep getting the word out. I've been wondering about the future of Radio EcoShock, and since I've got you on the phone, I'll just ask, what do you see the future?
Well, I had planned a couple of years ago to start helping several other people take it over. So I had my eyes out for other broadcasters who are younger, and I've talked to a couple of them actually about this. One is in Australia, another one's in Northern California. But the problem that's arose is a weird one. Because I've been doing this for 13 years and I've talked to so many scientists, I've actually kind of developed an education in climate science. And that's hard to replace. I haven't found somebody yet who can do that. But I think that will be the future, is that I'll start doing maybe one interview a show and somebody else will do the other one. And then I'll do one interview every now and then and somebody else or a group of somebody else's will take it over. Because I don't want to just let that chain of 100 stations drop out, or this whole idea of climate education drop out.
I've closed my blog a couple of times, mostly because I've gone broke and I've been frustrated. But then I realized, again, you know, I have to keep trying, and that's going to be my unasked-for advice to you. Even though you may have just 100 and a small listening audience, don't think things can't just suddenly turn around, because they definitely could. You know, it's going to take one media outlet, one major media outlet, to make mention of something like Radio EcoShock or a specific program or just something like that to get it out into the hands of millions. And then, boom, people will start asking you to, you know, can we cover your show?
It could be. I think the other possibility, what I really expect, is that I'll be totally co-opted by larger media when enough people become aware of climate change that they want more information, and it'll become part of the nightly weather forecast, and there'll be more news stories on it, and you know, that sort of thing.
And I've got a completely different take on what needs to be done. I know if you've read the blog, I definitely believe that we need to downsize immediately. You know, we need to do a lot less, not more. We need to abandon a lot of the things that have created climate change, and I mean yesterday. But I also realize that we won't do it. It's probably never going to happen.
Well, it may happen. The French Revolution did happen. Nobody expected it. And the Industrial Revolution happened, and nobody expected that. So it's possible there will be a large motion in human affairs. But as you say, the science is pretty clear that we've left it far too long, and so we are going to be hammered by climate disruption. But that doesn't mean that we won't regroup a few times. I mean, Rome fell, but there was a new Rome in Byzantium, and things tend to regroup. So I'm thinking that humans may survive, although I'm just now reading more and more about 95% of the insects in Central American rainforests are gone when people go back to measure them. The same in German nature preserves, the insects are gone. So there may be things happening at lower levels, even at the bacterial level, that we're really not aware of that will come around and bite us, as well as climate change.
I've been thinking about, you know, for the planet to lose this much ice, for example, you know, the energy imbalance that is taking place. You know, and I'm not a scientist. I don't try to come off as one. But it's kind of human hubris to assume that we're going to somehow find a way to restore that energy imbalance. You know, this has been set in motion for hundreds of years now. This isn't something that happened in the 1970s or the 1940s. You know, this has been going on a long time. Ever since we started, you know, changing the chemical composition of the atmosphere and causing, you know, all of this energy imbalance that's taking place. And we're never going to get that ice back, ever. As far as humans are concerned, it's never going to happen. I mean, we would have to be looking forward, you know, to 100,000 years or so. Climate stabilization won't happen for quite a long time. But our ability to survive here under these increasingly dangerous conditions for human survival, it's the wet bulb temperature that's going to get us, and not from heat stroke, from starvation. We are going to lose our food supply first.
We have been talking with Jonathan Richards. His Survival Acres blog has been influential for me. I've been reading it, and for many others. And I will put links for this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for chatting with us, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed it.
Alex, I appreciate the call. Thank you for the chance to share what's happening. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the new carbon-charged world, you are listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast around the world on radio and the Internet. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tune in. Turn on.
You know, we can deny many things and get away with it. But the one thing we can never get away with is denying climate change. Because everything else, be it national debt, health care, you know, disease, whatever, we can deny reality and eventually fix things. But there are two things we can't fix once they go wrong. One is nuclear holocaust, and we think we've contained that. We hope we have. And the other is climate change, because you can't go back. So on the one hand, we need to be realistic, and on the other hand, we need to be optimistic.
Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Ajit Varkey, professor of medicine at the University of California and co-author of the book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and Origins of the Human Mind. If denial is at the core of our ability to keep going, it also seems to be something that tobacco, food, and energy corporations can take advantage of for their profit. Ajit, from a doctor's perspective, are we being used precisely because denial can be triggered so easily?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can go further. It's only recently because of social norms that doctors stopped smoking. you know, I just looked it up, 40% of Chinese cardiologists smoke cigarettes. It's very easy for anybody who wants to purvey denial. The human mind just grabs at denial. Anything that makes us feel a little bit better about something that we should be taking seriously, we'll grab at that. It is very easy to manipulate the human mind in the direction that one wants.
This interview was suggested to me by Rob Milkarski, who blogs at undenial.wordpress.com. Rob has prepared a short summary of Varkey and Brower's work. It's worth your effort to get this, to see how we manage to deny so many realities. It's a wonder we survive it all.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. And we are experimenting with a brand new format for the podcast. I'm really excited to have my colleague of nearly 10 years, Asa Wynn-Stanley of the Electronic Intifada, joining me as co-host. Hi, Asa.
Hi, Nora. How are you?
I'm good. It's so good to hear your voice.
Yeah, likewise. 10 years, colleague of 10 years.
Yeah, it doesn't seem possible.
Let's just put a positive spin on that and say, you know, it shows the vast amount of experience we have, which is actually true. Like, well, there's no point in false modesty here. Come on, like, we're good. We do good stuff. But yeah, good. I'm excited
so,
for this.
Me too. And I think, you know, we're going to bring exactly the same level of deep analysis and in-depth conversations about human rights issues in Palestine. And we're going to be hearing from wonderful guests who, you know, are doing the work that EI has been known for. From, you know, analysts and journalists and activists, students, people who are putting Palestine on the map and making sure that this story gets the attention that it so deserves. So I'm excited to have you as co-host. And in a few minutes, we're going to go to an interview that you and I just recently did about one of your stories that's been making the rounds in social media. About the manufactured crisis of anti-Semitism in the UK Labour Party. But first, I wanted to see what stories have piqued your interest lately, either that we've published on EI or elsewhere in the media. What's been catching your attention lately?
Well, I read a story today from earlier in the month, actually, catching up with some stuff. And I read a story by our colleague Maureen about the Golan Heights. And the headline is Republicans Push Recognition of Israeli Annexation of the Golan. And this is a story about a small group of influential hard right Republicans who have been calling for US legitimization for the illegal Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights, which is a people who don't know, is a region in southern Syria, which Israel has occupied since, illegally since 1967. I try and read all our stories about the Golan because it's a really, it's a neglected story. Like, Israel has occupied a part of Syria for decades. And there's a lot of similarities with Palestine. So Israel has ethnically cleansed Syrians from the Golan Heights and has built settlements. They demolished Syrian villages in the Golan Heights. and built Jewish-only settlements on top of them. So this article is about how Ted Cruz, one of the worst people in America, is basically pushing for America to recognize the Golan occupation and to make it like, to say, yeah, this is actually part of Israel, not Syria anymore.
To completely annex it.
Yeah, to completely annex it. So in 1981, Israel declared the Golan to be part of its state, like, which is some, a move that it hasn't made in the West Bank, because, you know, they don't have anything near a majority of the population there, and annexation would sort of imply giving citizenship, which they don't want to do, because there's too many Palestinians in the West Bank. The Syrian population in the Golan Heights, because it was ethnically cleansed to a far greater degree, in terms of percentage of the population, it makes it easier for them to sort of annex. So what Ted Cruz and these Republicans are doing is trying to push for recognition, push for, like, so it's like a sign of how the Israel lobby effectively thinks it's captured the White House. Like, so Trump is the most pro-Israel president ever. Like, each president is more pro-Israel than the next. So it's something that, like, with John Bolton in place as the national security advisor, he's also incredibly Zionist. So, like,
and now with Elliot Abrams back in power, Elliot Abrams, who helped usher in dictatorships and allies of U.S. Imperialist hegemony all over the world, including in Palestine. He's back working for the Trump administration's goals in Latin America.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like all the worst people from the Bush era.
Yeah.
And going even further back are just sort of back, basically. So, yeah, that's what I was looking at. What have you been looking at this week, Nora?
Well, we haven't published anything on this yet, but definitely forthcoming. I've been watching closely what's happening in the Senate. Marco Rubio, who's the Republican senator from Florida, he was pushing for the first bill of the reopened government to basically protect states in punishing supporters of the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Unfortunately, on Monday night, that his bill, after being defeated three times in January during the shutdown, the bill was passed. It passed a motion of cloture, which means that it then gets to have a full debate in the Senate. And then if it passes there, goes to the House. And if it passes the House, it becomes law. So I've been watching that very carefully. But while that has been going on, there is a brand new group in the Democratic Party who have formed in order to combat what they see as a dissociation with kind of party line affiliation with Israel all these years.
Yeah,
This
bill you talking about is a bill that would effectively outlaw BDS in the U.S. Is that a fair sort of summary of
there's two different bills. The one that seeks to really criminalize and even inflict prison sentences on supporters of the boycott campaign has been kind of stalled in the Senate so far. That's the Israel Anti-Boycott Act that was proposed by Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. But this one, Marco Rubio's bill, really just does the job of protecting states. There have been 26 states so far that have passed these anti-boycott measures. And so Rubio's bill would protect those states in upholding punishments against supporters of the boycott. So, you know, whatever states decide to do, if they decide to outlaw BDS activism and campaigning, or to just levy fines and punishments against supporters of the boycott, then it would be the state's rights to do so, and they would be further protected against any sort of courts and these laws, of course, have been challenged in federal courts so far. Kansas and Arizona, the laws there have been blocked by federal courts. There's been another challenge to the state law in Texas, and we're seeing another one in Maryland, actually Ben Cardin's state, a law there being challenged.
States' rights is something. It's quite resonant and quite apt, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it really hasn't gone away.
Yeah. Right. So this new group, then, what is it called and what?
So this new group, they're calling themselves the Democratic Majority for Israel, DMI, the Democratic Majority for Israel. Their New York Times on Monday said that, quote, with polls showing that liberals and younger voters are increasingly less sympathetic to Israel and a handful of vocal supporters of Palestinian rights arriving in Congress, the new group, the Democratic Majority for Israel, is planning to wage a campaign to remind elected officials about what they call the party's shared values and interests with one of America's strongest allies. And there's a bunch of, like, you know, bemoaning of new Democratic congressional representatives such as Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib, who have either pledged their support of the right to boycott or have definitely upheld, you know, their beliefs in that the U.S. government shouldn't interfere in people's political opinions. So I thought that you had a really interesting take when we were talking offline earlier today about what even the branding of this Democratic Majority for Israel means. Tell us what your take was.
Yeah, I thought that it's obviously it's propaganda. It's pro-Israel propaganda, but it's like it's really shit propaganda too, because like they're saying that. Their point is, oh, we need to argue for a democratic majority for Israel. So they're starting off on the back foot. Like they're starting off straight away admitting that there's no democratic majority for Israel, like at least at the grassroots. So they're starting off saying, well, we're trying to argue for the democratic majority for Israel. But what, like, it's I suppose we should welcome this, really. Like, it's
it really shows also the desperation that Israel lobby groups who are financing these representatives are going to, you know, like there's a lot of panic and disarray by these, you know, kind of long held lobby organizations like AIPAC and the ADL and the American Jewish Committee, who are in secret memos. They're really crestfallen that their narrative, that their propaganda efforts are not being taken seriously anymore, because people have more information than ever before about what Israel has been doing to Palestinians.
Yeah, and it reminds me of Labour Friends of Israel in the UK. There's differences as well, because Labour Friends of Israel is a long-standing group. But like, it's just, if it shapes up the same way, it'll kind of be a front organisation to funnel pro-Israel money into the Democratic Party, like has been done in the Labour Party over here. To try and interfere to as a way for Israel to kind of interfere in elections overseas, and it's something that I don't know. I don't think it's going to have a lot of success, to be honest. Like beyond what they already have, I think it kind of is in danger of backfiring from their point of view. But I guess we'll see. We'll see how.
Yeah, I'll be keeping a close eye on DMI. The Democratic Majority for Israel, to see exactly who jumps on board and which lobby organizations hold their hand, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be interesting and probably pretty nauseating as well.
Yeah, most definitely.
Well, let's go to a quick music break. And when we come back, Asa, I will interview you about your recent story on the, as I said, the manufactured crisis of anti-Semitism in the UK Labour Party. We'll be right back.
This edition of the Electronic Intifada podcast will be continued next week.
We don't need no water, let them all go for the burn.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies and History, who assesses the current political and economic crisis in Venezuela and the role of the Trump administration in its attempt to oust current President Nicolas Maduro from power. William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with TruthOut.org, who considers the prospects for a bipartisan deal being made to avoid another government shutdown or a Trump emergency declaration bypassing Congress to get funding for his border wall. And Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder and CEO of Efficiency for All, who talks about the importance of energy policy and its relationship to equity for all people and the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Outside the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the Hong Kong-based NGO Crossroads Foundation played out a simulation known as A Day in the Life of a Refugee. It gave the bankers and CEOs who participated a taste of what life is like for asylum seekers, many of whom are targets of violent crime. With anti-immigration political parties and reactionary policies gaining support in Western nations, the aid group that runs the simulation wants politicians, officials, and chief executives attending Davos to understand the issue from the frightening perspective of a refugee. The United Nations recently leveled criticism at European nations for preventing boatloads of migrants from disembarking at safe ports and relying instead on Libya's Coast Guard to return them to the dangerous North African country. 3 years ago, the European Union pressured Niger, a major transit point for migrants, to criminalize the transport of foreigners north to the Africa coast. In exchange, the EU is underwriting jobs for former smugglers. The program, in part, has helped to reduce migration from Niger to Europe by more than 75%. However, many human traffickers are now seeking more remote and perilous travel routes to take migrants through the Sahara Desert, a path which carries a far greater risk of death. In late March 2018, Mexican Marines carried out a late-night raid on a house in the border city of Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, detaining two men, a local car mechanic, and a friend from Oaxaca planning to cross the border to the U.S. The two men were among 51 people in Nuevo Laredo who disappeared during the first 5 months of 2018. Over the last 12 years, some 37,000 Mexicans have disappeared during Mexico's bloody war on drugs. Family members of the disappeared are putting pressure on Mexico's new president, Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO. During his election campaign, Obrador pledged to investigate the fate of 43 students from a teacher's college who disappeared in 2014. But The Nation magazine reports that AMLO has been virtually silent about the tens of thousands of other Mexicans who have disappeared. Last November, Mexico's Supreme Court overturned a law that permits the Mexican army to engage in law enforcement activities. But by the end of Obrador's first week in office, 50,000 military police were deployed to 150 regions of the country. López Obrador asserts that these units will be combined into a new National Guard force over the next 3 years, and eventually will be under the command of the Army. However, critics maintain that AMLO's plan is a repeat of the mistake of militarization from the previous two administrations. The day after the partial U.S. government shutdown began, the Internal Revenue Service sent out a notice of intent to seize the property of California businessman Aaron Cadell, who had been in settlement talks with the IRS. During the recently ended partial government shutdown, IRS computers continued to crank out asset seizure notices, but there were few people still working at the IRS call centers to deal with complaints. According to Intercept, many small businesses were trapped in a Kafkaesque maze with no way of settling tax disputes. Cadell, who owns a small chain of bakeries, claims the IRS made a mistake on the status of his payroll tax deposits. But settlement talks ended with the government shutdown, and an asset seizure letter was sent out. Cadell surmised that other individuals and businesses were in the same catch-22 situation. Perhaps the most out-of-luck people in the recently ended shutdown are the thousands of workers the federal government pays the least, low-wage contract workers who perform janitorial, security, and food service tasks at public buildings. Unlike furloughed federal employees who will receive back pay for wages missed, contract workers will likely receive no restitution. However, some Democrats in Congress, including freshman House member Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, support legislation that would reinstate back pay for low-wage contract workers who were held hostage during this longest government shutdown in U.S. history. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Venezuela, already gripped by a severe political and economic crisis, is now the focus of a concerted effort by the Trump administration to oust the South American nation's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. Juan Guaido, opposition party president of the National Assembly, declared himself interim president of the country during a massive anti-government protest on January 23rd, not long after Maduro was sworn into office for a second term. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate president, maintaining that the May 20th election won by Maduro lacked credibility. Canada, the European Union, and other Latin American nations governed by conservatives followed the U.S. lead, insisting that Maduro step down and new elections be called. However, in this escalating crisis, Maduro retains the support of Russia, China, Mexico, Bolivia, Uruguay, Cuba, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. On January 28th, President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton announced new additional sanctions against Venezuela's state-owned oil company, depriving Maduro's government of $7 billion in assets and $3 billion more by the end of the year. The imposition of new sanctions was preceded by the Trump appointment of Elliot Abrams as the administration's new special envoy on the Venezuelan crisis, who's well known for his guilty plea for lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal and his association with Central American death squads during the U.S. dirty wars in the region. Your reporter spoke with Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies and History at Pomona College, who assesses the current political and economic crisis in Venezuela and the risk of civil war resulting from U.S. intervention.
I think that the overall crisis boils down to the fact that Guaido, by declaring himself the interim president, is a non-elected figure. He was a relatively unknown figure in the National Assembly. And to be immediately recognized by the Trump administration, the conservative governments of South America, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Colombia, and then within a matter of hours by the European Union, speaks to a very much of an orchestrated effort here to unseat Nicolás Maduro, which is relatively unprecedented in Latin America. We've had other efforts at constitutional coups, whether they be with Juan Beltrán Aristide in Haiti or with Mr. Zelaya in Honduras, or even with Chavez in 2002, where the U.S. and the Bush administration backed a coup against Chavez, arguing that he had resigned his post. So that in one way we see is a coup. That does not negate the fact that Venezuela is facing a severe economic crisis, where shortages of foodstuffs and medicine are a daily occurrence, where 3 million people have left the country, and where Maduro has proven incompetent in running the economy. But if that's the condition, the reality is that what is being attempted is an effort to unseat president, claiming that he's not legitimate, claiming because the opposition did not participate in the May 20th election, that somehow he is no longer legitimate, and that foreign powers can dictate who will be the president of Venezuela. And that's a very, very problematic precedent for democracy in Latin America.
Professor Salas, what are the chances, as Nicolas Maduro has called for, mediation by the United Nations and the Vatican to address this problem in a nonviolent way, in a manner that won't create more upheaval for the people of Venezuela?
I think it's right now the odds are very, very little. The opposition has essentially opted for the policy of foreign powers and pressuring Maduro by not participating in the May 20th election and by walking away from the negotiating table when José Luis Zapatero, the former Spanish minister, was negotiating with the opposition and the government rules of engagement, and walking away from that. They essentially have clearly demarcated the fact that they are not interested in negotiations. They seek the ouster. And the problem is that in seeking the ouster of a government, whether you like him or not, what you're doing is creating conditions for instability. Because what's to say tomorrow Maduro is ousted and now the Chavistas are in the opposition and they do the same thing to those who have assumed power? My point being that there has to be a negotiated settlement, that is the only possible solution. And by recognizing Guaido, by pushing for a break in the military, by putting the society with sanctions between the rock and the hard spot, they've essentially eliminated a negotiating option from the table and have made Maduro's departure the only issue subject to conversation.
Professor Salas, what are the chances are that we could see armed conflict break out in Venezuela in a much more substantial way than the street violence we've seen in recent years? What about the United States intervention at this point? There's even been talk from the Trump administration that they're not taking the sending of U.S. troops to Venezuela off the table for possible future policies they may pursue. What are your concerns around U.S. intervention or with the United States backing a surrogate force taking up arms and fighting the Venezuelan military?
That's my greatest concern. Those who can recall the Dominican Republic recognize that the Johnson administration hid behind a so-called multinational force that involved the Brazilians and others. Bolsonaro has already spoken openly about wanting to oust Maduro. So has Iván Duque in Colombia. So have other governments in Latin America. That's why, again, I say they are not interested in democracy in Latin America. They're interested in regime change in Venezuela. Today, Bolton, as he spoke with Mnuchin to announce the new sanctions against Venezuela, on his yellow briefing paper that he had, was written 5,000 U.S. troops to Colombia. That could have been psychological ops, or it could have been U.S. troops being sent to Colombia. And again, when you have something like that happening, the first thing one thinks about is some sort of incident, a border incident, something happens, as we saw with the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, or as we saw in the case of Iraq, and so-called weapons of mass destruction. Any of those things can happen as a pretext or as a precursor to then be able to take part in an intervention. And that's what worries me the most, because that would be disastrous for Venezuela and it would be disastrous for Latin America. And long term, these invasions have not gone good. If you're in the U.S., you can only think of what's happened in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Honduras, in Haiti, in El Salvador. The record is one of death and destruction.
That was Miguel Tinker Salas,
professor of Latin American Studies, History, Chicana, and Latina Studies at Pomona College. Find more analysis of the Venezuela crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After delivering a speech on January 25th that ended the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, President Trump agreed to a temporary funding measure that allowed federal employees to return to work. That legislation, however, doesn't include any funds he demanded to build his southern border wall. In fact, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office reported that the U.S. economy lost $11 billion, including $3 billion that's gone forever, during the 35 days of the partial federal government shutdown. As he reopened the government, the president threatened to shut it down again or declare a national emergency if Democrats and Republicans failed to negotiate a deal to provide $5.7 billion in funding for his U.S.-Mexico border wall by February 15th. During his TV speech, Mr. Trump repeated his discredited attacks on immigrants and refugees, blaming them for a host of problems in the U.S. According to a recent Quinnipiac University national poll, 56% of Americans surveyed blamed Trump and Republican leaders for the shutdown, with only 34% saying they believe Democrats were responsible. Your reporter spoke with William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with truthout.org, who assesses the prospects for a bipartisan deal being made to avoid another government shutdown or a Trump emergency declaration bypassing Congress to get border wall funding.
So in terms of what I think is going to come out of the next 3 weeks, there's an element of massive uncertainty involved, of course, because you have this thing in the White House who agrees with the last person he talked to, and 9 times out of 10, lately, the last person he talks to is Stephen Miller, who is the most shining fascist we've had anywhere near the federal government since Curtis LeMay. So you could give him 10 walls and a partridge in a pear tree, and he could still decide to throw the thing into disorder. So there's that, and that's just the elephant in the room, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. My strong suspicion is that the conversation is going to be less about making Trump happy and more about putting together a reasonable package, even a smaller one, because immigration is an incredibly complex issue, and 3 weeks is probably not enough to get it done. So some sort of Band-Aid package that allows him to get out of this with some sort of face, no wall, and a long, hard conversation from the people in the Republican Congress, Mitch McConnell and the rest of them, about the exact weight of the building that will fall on him and the entire Republican Party if he either shuts down the government again or declares an emergency for a non-existent emergency and winds up immediately in court and doesn't get his money anyway. Friday was one of the happiest days that I've had in a really, really long time, but we are still 40 miles of bad road ahead of us before anything starts to make sense again. That's just the fact.
William Rivers Pitt, are you concerned that a coalition of moderate Democrats and Republicans in the House would put together a package of $5.7 billion of funding for a smart wall or more agents, more immigration judges? Are you concerned that this would validate Trump's declaration that there is an emergency at the border, that it would confirm to his base that he was right all along, that the Democrats closed down the government unnecessarily because they didn't come over to Trump's side?
It bothers me. It bothers me deeply. And if we had more than 3 weeks to kick it around, I'm certain that we could probably come up with something. But this is disaster government, like disaster capitalism. The guy set the building on fire. Now he's haggling over the price of the hose. I mean, there is absolutely no emergency down at the border. But if this guy goes and shuts the government down, we already saw what was about to happen. It is a damn miracle that nobody got killed with the airline safety being affected the way it was. The other areas that the shutdown was affecting, battered women's shelters were being closed down because they lacked funding. I have not read any reports that someone who was being abused was unable to get to a shelter and was hurt or killed, but that could very easily have happened. Medical treatment on Native reservations essentially ceased to exist. So there were people being hurt there. And if it got on much longer, we were going to get into money for SNAP and a variety of other issues that the White House didn't give a tinker's damn about. All they were focused on was airline travel, because as some funny guy on TV the other day, I can't remember, they might have been Bill Maher, was like, yeah, the reason why he opened the government again is because his rich friends were telling him they couldn't get from D.C. to Washington.
Right. The
unfortunate truth is that the threat of the shutdown is very real, and we're going to have to face him down and force him to do it again rather than give him this stupid wall. But I suspect that if an opportunity to come up with something, especially if it includes protections, permanent protections for the Dreamers, the DACA Act kids, then we could fold that into whatever this happens to be and just choke on the increase in agents and the electric wall. That might be something that would happen. It would make me deeply unhappy, but I'm casting around for alternatives given the people we're dealing with, and I'm not coming up with very many.
That was William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with truthout.org. Find more commentary and analysis on Trump's demand for a border wall and the recent government shutdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A half dozen scientific reports released in the past 4 months show that the Earth is well on its way to becoming unsustainable for humans and other life forms. A special report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says humanity has just a dozen years or so to keep greenhouse gas emissions below the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming over the pre-industrial age in order to prevent disastrous and irreversible changes to Earth's climate. That requires nations collectively around the world to sharply reduce to zero the amount of greenhouse gas emissions released into the atmosphere. The easiest and cheapest method of reducing carbon emissions, apart from not burning fossil fuels, is through energy efficiency. At the January 12th Achieving Our Shared Energy Goals Forum in Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by the group Efficiency for All, speakers addressed the ways individuals and governments can reduce their energy use. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder and CEO of Efficiency for All, based in Windsor, Connecticut, which is an educational and outreach nonprofit focused on sustainability and leadership training for underrepresented and at-risk communities. Here, Mejias explains the importance of energy policy and its relationship to equity for all people and the environment.
So I wanted to find a way to explain energy policy and energy processes to the common people of the world who don't work in energy and therefore don't understand where energy comes from or how we use it. And energy policy is much like any law policy. It has a mix of information in there, making the sausage, so to speak. So energy in Connecticut is 95% non-renewable and 5% renewable. But no matter how we generate our electricity, how we use it, and what we do with it, impacts all people. And so I came up with an analogy that our energy mix is similar to making rice and beans. When we're creating energy policy or our energy mix for the state of Connecticut, that if we utilize efficiency as a demand reduction and draw down consumption as the basis, which would be, I call, the rice of it, then we can throw in any beans we'd like. And those beans can be diverse. They could be red beans. They could be black beans. And I like to say they could be things like wind or solar, or they might be carbon reduction like nuclear, or they might be gas pipelines. But whatever type of mix we make with our recipe, who writes the recipe and who cooks the recipe and how that recipe is ultimately served depends on what dish we get in the end. But no matter how we develop a recipe or who cooks it or writes it or what spices we choose to put in it, it's important that everyone gets a dish of rice and beans. it is very important that we have a strategy, that having a goal without a plan is just a wish. And in order to meet the carbon reduction goals and the energy demand reduction goals and move towards a cleaner, renewable, sustainable energy source, like 100% renewable are some groups' goals and request, that you have to do that strategically. So, for example, we can't continue expanding gas for heating and expanding gas for electric generation and still want a low carbon future. Gas is just a fossil fuel like oil or like coal. So if we want to move in that direction, then we need to have a strategy that brings us there over time. So we would say we're going to decrease demand by 30% using efficiency and making the thermal boundaries of buildings tighter so we're not wasting heating and cooling loads. And then that would decrease our demand on our gas supplies, which becomes a problem. And every time we increase gas demand for electricity or heating and cooling, we actually increase our electric rates because it's the same gas that we use to generate electricity. And if we want to, let's say some groups would like to electrify heating and cooling to get off of oil or propane, which are dirty fossil fuels in people's mind, and I agree. But in order to do that, we can't plug into the electricity that is generated by gas and nuclear, although considered to be a less carbon-intense source of energy. Gas is also just a fossil fuel that is extracted from the ground. So we should be looking for fuels that aren't requiring drilling, digging, blowing things up, like wind and solar, hydroelectric, that are more renewable.
One of the speakers who followed you last Saturday, she put a hat on, and a floppy hat, and said that she wanted to glam up her pitch about energy efficiency. She feels like it's not considered as glamorous as talking about all these different exciting renewables. Do you agree? And what do you say about that? How do you get people more excited about energy efficiency?
Although not as sexy as solar or wind or carbon trading or carbon taxing, efficiency does absolutely draw down our carbon emissions, therefore protecting human health, lowering the cost of energy, increasing the efficacy of our renewable resources, and really meeting the common goal of growing our economy as well and stabilizing energy so we don't have things like brownouts and blackouts, which are real in other places. So efficiency has really been overlooked, although it has consistently met the demand reduction goals of the state of Connecticut and has a 1-7 return on investment and affords Connecticut 34,000 local jobs, generates $1.4 billion of gross state product and $140 million of net tax revenue. We silly decided to divert that really effective program, again, 1-7 return on investment, and dump it into our general fund, which isn't returning anything in as far as economic growth goes to the state of Connecticut. And so what we're doing is calling for common sense policies as they relate to energy and ensuring that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater while chasing the idea of something fancy or shiny. But at the end of the day, really, it's just the simple concept of using less to do more and making really intelligent choices and not knee-jerk reactions to policies in our state.
That was Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder of Efficiency for All and Green Eco Warriors, nonprofits focused on sustainability and leadership training for underrepresented and at-risk communities. Learn more about how communities are advancing energy efficiency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on D-Program Radio World in Norwich, Norfolk, United Kingdom, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall,
Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Trump trumped. After over a month of the partial government shutdown, President Trump threw in the towel, bowing to an avalanche of political and economic disaster. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco emerged as Trump's most powerful political protagonist since his election. She quietly stood her ground, ignoring his bombast, until he ceded his hold over the shutdown and gave in. Some 800,000 federal workers faced truly challenging conditions after losing checks for two pay periods. Trump officials, some of the richest people in the U.S., snorted derisively over the workers' pay problems. They seemed to echo Marie Antoinette during the French Revolution. "Let them eat cake," she said. How will these people view the president, who brought nothing but pain and worry to them? Do you want to bet that there will not be another shutdown during Trump's term? Hey, put money on it. Trump revealed to his base supporters that he was in over his head by ordering a fruitless shutdown. It won't happen again anytime soon. Bet on it. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Decided that he will determine who is and who isn't the legitimate leader of a foreign nation. He has said that Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela was illegitimate, and he supported Maduro's opponent for leadership of the nation. What if Maduro declared that Trump, who received some 3 million less votes than his opponent, Hillary Clinton, was illegitimate? Who would listen? For in truth, Trump sits in the White House only because of the slavery-era artifact known as the Electoral College, an institution designed to deny democracy to millions of Africans and to assure Southern hegemony. Isn't the so-called Electoral College fundamentally illegitimate? The Electoral College should be immediately abolished. In a September 9, 2018 edition of the New York Times, Trump officials touched base with Venezuelan military officials to support a coup, a against President Maduro. For much of the 19th and the 20th centuries, the U.S. decided who should rule all throughout Latin America based upon such nonsense as the Monroe Doctrine, a pretext for American imperialism. Lest we miss the play, Monroe is back. What a shame. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Gathered today, we do so amid the fire and smoke of chaos, both figuratively and literally. In France, the city of light, Paris, is surrounded by the flames of discontent. The rural communities are up in arms about lowering wages and the hiking of taxes. These people, clad in their yellow vests, feel that they are forgotten by the central government and often ignored by them and the urban elites. In Britain, the nation is trying to come to terms with a serious self-imposed wound, Brexit. Brexit, or a British exit from the European Union, is a British attempt to go it alone, but to do so means that the country will lose billions of pounds or dollars as international companies flee from London and as jobs also leave the country. London, called the city for its impressive economic strength, is frittering away that strength because of Brexit. The U.S. economy, roaring like a lion as it breaks all records of the Dow Stock Exchange, is now falling like stones as stocks reflect losses that bring to mind the Great Depression of the 1930s. Why should we worry about such things? Because when the economy falls, when economic insecurity enters a nation, it opens the door to fear, and history has shown us that it opens the door into fascism. Europe is already home to formidable rightist forces. The events of a year ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, showed the sinister flash of fascism in a major American city. These fears, once unleashed, cannot be easily brought back under control. These furies of the mind light fires in consciousness, and fires in the mind can only too soon become fires in fact, which consumes and destroys societies. Fascism, or the collusion of corporate power with state governmental power, can result
when traditional governments have failed to resolve economic problems in states awash in economic insecurity. John Bellamy Foster, editor of the American Socialist Magazine Monthly Review, defines fascism as characterized by its virulently xenophobic, ultra-nationalist tendencies, which is rooted primarily in the lower middle class and relatively privileged sections of the working class, in alliance with monopoly capital. History has shown that the deification of leaders, and well as the exaltation of the military, is also a feature of fascist states. As capitalism reaches its market limits, it seeks other forms through which it can extract profits. Fascism. The late German dramatist Bertolt Brecht asks in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Thus, we can glimpse a key relationship between fascism and capitalism. One is but a tool of an economic system which utilizes the other for power and profit. One would think that the heinous and horrors of massacres of World War II would awaken us to the fascism and the neo-fascism that we see emerging in Europe and the U.S. One would think, yes, but neoliberalism itself, a political system designed to serve corporate interests by betraying the public sphere for private capitalist accumulation, has prepared the ground for this neo-fascist and crypto-fascist ascendancy. Neoliberalists like the Clintons built the machine we now name mass incarceration. How could this not strengthen and deepen a system built on repression of workers, racism, and corporate control and domination? In Britain, Brexit spells economic disaster and the devolution of Britain as one of the centers of Europower. In France, attempts to operate the nation as if it were a simple business run by a banker has run into a wall. One richly emblazoned with mottos comparing the president with kings who faced the guillotine. In America, the notion of president who was a businessman has lost much of its luster as the state appears like a site of chaos and sheer incompetence. And beneath it all lurks the threat of fascism, ugly, racist, profoundly undemocratic, and beholden only to corporate capitalist power. It is a time for all of us of awakening. Thank you for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What are some of the elite forces behind the rise of young climate activist Greta Thunberg? Is there a Western ethnic bias in the environmental movement's media strategies? Are proposed climate solutions and international gatherings like the UN climate talks little more than green window dressing for profit-making ventures? What is in the Paris Accord that should concern social and environmentally minded people? On this week's episode of the Global Research NewsHour, as more and more people around the world are confronting climate stresses like the current cold snap and demanding serious attention to climate change, we ask some discerning and uncomfortable questions as to the extent climate awareness is being co-opted into serving the agendas of a few elite interests at the expense of the environment and the genuine aspirations of legions of youth attracted to the message of an outspoken Swedish teenaged activist. We spend the hour in conversation with Corey Morningstar, who's just produced a dynamic new series of articles taking a look at the background of Greta Thunberg and forces at work behind the scenes, and probe the agenda being furthered in the name of environmental justice. On this week's program, Saving the Earth or Saving Capitalism? The inconvenient truth behind today's youth climate campaigns. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 1st, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The developing economies, such as India and Pakistan, are always hungry for foreign direct investment to sustain economic growth, and this investment mostly comes from the Western corporations. When the business roundtables of the Paris-based International Chamber of Commerce form pressure groups and engage in collective bargaining activities, the nascent and fragile developing economies don't have a choice but to toe their line. State sovereignty, that sovereign nation states are at liberty to pursue independent policies, particularly economic and trade policies, is a myth. Just like the ruling elites of the developing countries, which maintain a stranglehold and monopoly over domestic politics, similarly the neocolonial powers and multinational corporations control international politics and the global economic order. Any state in the international arena which dares to transgress the trade and economic policies laid down by neocolonial powers and multinational corporations becomes an international pariah, like Castro's Cuba, Mugabe's Zimbabwe, or more recently, Maduro's Venezuela. That comes from the article, U.S. Sanctions as a Tool to Perpetuate Neocolonialism, by Noman Sadiq, posted January 31st. Do the U.S. and its allies have a moral or ethical right to determine the political future of Venezuela? This question is breezed past, and we move on to the question of how this self-evident authority is best exercised. This is the scope of debate in the New York Times and among virtually all U.S. media outlets. To ante up in the poker game of serious people discussing foreign policy seriously, one is obligated to register an official condemnation of the official bad regime. This is so everyone knows you accept the core premises of U.S. regime change, but oppose it on pragmatic or legalistic grounds. That comes from the article, Your Complete Guide to the NY Times Support of U.S.-Backed Coups in Latin America, by Adam Johnson, posted January 31st, originally published at Truthdig. On January 24th, 2019, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has stated, quote, humanity now faces two simultaneous existential threats, either of which would be cause for extreme concern and immediate action. Attention. These major threats, nuclear weapons and climate change, were exacerbated this past year, 2018, by the increased use of information warfare to undermine democracy around the world amplifying risk from these and other threats and putting the future of civilization in extraordinary danger, unquote. History is replete with instances where an end has been falsely predicted. Where do present climate science-based projections and the probabilities of nuclear war lie? That comes from the article, Imagining Reality, 2 minutes to midnight on the clock of the atomic scientists, by Dr. Andrew Glickson, posted January 31st. The U.S. Vice President's call-out to the Venezuelan people to rise up and embrace Guaido as their president failed. Of the Americas, governments installed by the U.S. have supported the U.S. position. Countries of the Americas controlled by right-wing middle classes at the service of corporate policies and wealth also support the U.S. position. Western media explain a need for change rising from the country's humanitarian crisis, which on examination is an economic crisis rising from very low prices of oil and then the debilitating U.S.-initiated sanctions to sideline Venezuela's attempts at economic recovery. As the largest holder of oil resources in the world, Venezuela's political and economic difficulties are consistently traced to foreign corporate interests. That comes from the article, A Note on the Crime Against Venezuela, by J.B. Gerald, posted January 31st. A former United Nations rapporteur has criticized the U.S. for engaging in economic warfare against Venezuela, which he claimed was the real reason for the economic and humanitarian crisis facing the country. Alfred de Zayas, who last year became the first UN rapporteur to visit Venezuela for 21 years, also suggested in his recently published UN report that U.S. sanctions on the country are illegal and could amount to crimes against humanity under international law. Mr. de Zayas, an American lawyer, writer, historian, and former secretary of the UN Human Rights Council, presented his Venezuela report to the HRC in September. In the report, which can be read in full here, Mr. de Zayas recommended, among other actions, that the International Criminal Court investigate economic sanctions against Venezuela as possible crimes against humanity under Article 7 of the Rome Statute. In the report conclusions, Mr. de Zayas, who is an expert in the fields of human rights and international law, went on to say the solution to the Venezuelan crisis lay, quote, in good faith negotiations between the government and the opposition, an end to the economic war, and the lifting of sanctions, unquote. That comes from the article, Economic Warfare Against Venezuela, Illegal U.S. Sanctions Causing Economic and Humanitarian Crisis, according to former UN rapporteur. Posted January 31st, originally published at Irish Examiner. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Adults keep saying we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. I want you to act as if you would in a crisis. I want you to act as if the house was on fire. Because it is.
That was the voice of 16-year-old Greta Thunberg speaking in Davos, Switzerland during the World Economic Forum last week. She's become the face of the modern-day climate movement and has inspired legions of young people around the world with her school strike for climate, in which she is demanding action on the part of world leaders to confront climate change as an emergency. As we discussed on the show with Dar Jamail 2 weeks ago, the hazards posed by climate change are acute and worsening. In recent days, a polar vortex is bringing intense cold to North America. Young people the world over are rising to the challenge and compelling their elders to act. And as this show goes to air, youth in the city of Winnipeg are scheduled to host another climate action, this time at Winnipeg City Hall. This action is also inspired by Greta's example. But are the rich and powerful being moved by the Greta Thunbergs of the world, or are they somehow manipulating youth energies and emotions to boost their own bottom line? This is the inconvenient truth presented in a recent four-part series by Corey Morningstar entitled The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent. A past guest of this program, Corey Morningstar is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist focusing on global ecological collapse and political analysis of the non-profit industrial complex. She resides in London, Ontario. Her recent writings can be found on Wrong Kind of Green, The Art of Annihilation, and Counterpunch. And her writing has also been published by Bolivia Rising and Cambio, the official newspaper of the plurinational state of Bolivia. Corey, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me back on the show.
You know, it did strike me as being a little peculiar that this one girl, and no doubt she's very intelligent and charismatic and dedicated, but there are lots of young people out there doing rather amazing things. They don't all become stars the way she has, and so that kind of got me feeling a little suspicious. But what were you able to uncover?
So when I started digging into it, I found out right away basically that Greta, and I mean, this girl, she's lovely, right? I mean, I didn't hear what you just played, but every time I speak to her, she's compelling, she's articulate, she's what's not to love. I mean, she says all the right things and everything that people should be saying. And so she really does have, she really does evoke, you know, a lot of emotion when you listen to her. Anyway, when I went back right away, I found fairly easily her family is very, very, very famous in Sweden. And her mom is a big celebrity, and she does work. No, I don't know whether it's paid or not. It doesn't even matter. She does work for Greenpeace, WWF. You know, they're both fully corporatized NGOs. Anyway, from this really elite family, which, you know, whatever. When I went back, I had noticed her accounts, her social media accounts, were set up last June. So between, you know, and then I looked at things I always look at. I mean, who she was following, and it's all, I mean, she's following basically the creme de la creme of the professional, I don't want to use the word activist, but that's what they're referred to in this society. But she's following the creme de la creme of all the highly paid professional people that work in the so-called environmental movement. You know, and these are names like Tony Jupiter, who's, you know, key person for natural capital. Natural capital, when I say that, that's the financialization, privatization of nature, payments for ecosystem services. She's following all these people that it takes a long time to get to know who they are. You know,
it seems unusual for somebody who's like a teenager to be following people like that, even if they are super dedicated to the environment.
Yeah, like these are people that you really have to be in the movement, especially within North America, to understand even who they are and what they do, right? So anyway, I thought that was really odd. And within those accounts being set up in June, and then her very first day of her school strike, that was August 20th, I believe. Mm. And, yeah, she went from that to within a day or two being basically covered by 20 or 30 news agencies. It was really odd because in the pictures that were taken of her, there's just her with this, you know, cardboard sign on the sidewalk. And you think, wow, that's, you know, in what world does this happen where all of a sudden someone who's sitting on the sidewalk gets global news coverage within a day or two? Mm-hmm. You know, and then within days, it literally exploded. I believe by September 1st, she was, you know, great big pictures in The Guardian, The New Yorker, I mean, international status in about 10 days. I mean, yeah. This is incredible, right? And then I started digging into that, and then the very, very first pictures of her taken were by an outfit called We Don't Have Time. And so I started digging into that, and then I came across pictures of Greta holding a sign saying we don't have time. And then what that is, that's another outfit that's been in partnership with Al Gore's Climate Reality Project, and it's actually a software startup. It's a tech company, and they're creating an app, and they they have over 400 investors, and it's this app for climate change, and they hope that it will become, you know, billion-dollar, huge, profitable, software application that will supposedly help the climate. So anyway, that's the first thing. That was huge. And then further, if you dig into We Don't Have Time, that's basically the first section is all about We Don't Have Time. And that's they're affiliated with Al Gore's climate project. It's just so broad, it's hard to really explain it all.
Yeah.
Without getting into the reading.
Yes.
But it's, you know, this didn't just happen out of the blue. I mean, that's where everything came from, this firm. We Don't Have Time. Greta is a youth trustee to the We Don't Have Time Foundation.
Yeah. One of two,
and then the other one, Jamie
Margolin.
Margolin, she's from the United States. And if you go back through the social media, you'll see that she's been involved with We Don't Have Time prior, like back in the, I think it starts maybe June. So they're already involved with Jamie Margolin before Greta Thunberg in building that relationship. And they're all in partnership and trained by Al Gore personally and involved in the Climate Reality Project.
Okay, so this group, We Don't Have Time, this startup, it's developed this technological app that helps, as I understand it from reading it, it ranks different companies according to how sustainable they are, or it allows people to...
Yeah, I think it can do anything. Like, you rank people, you can rank politicians. Basically, it can be used as a tool. Like, it's a lot of the people on board, for example, are behavioral change experts, which is becoming a big part of government, setting up these behavioral change units, nudge units. So that's, like, a huge thing happening that's been underway, and that's something that a lot of NGOs, for instance, have as specialized in, that type of behavioral change. Creating whole societies to conform in certain ways as desired by the people, you know, that are creating, the different ways they want society to go, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they're on the board. They have coaching, global upmanning in Sweden's involved. Basically, part one goes through all the different people involved in that. And then, of course, that connects into right over into North America, into the Democratic Party, the Democrat Socialists. I mean, I'm Canadian, so I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't know the party.
The Democratic Socialist of America.
Like the back
of
my hand.
Yeah.
But it definitely is all related and connects to the Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sanders campaign, 350, basically all the heavy hitters in the U.S.
Okay, so you're basically mentioning that Greta is essentially not acting in a vacuum, that somehow this campaign has been worked by that one startup, and it seems to be like this non-governmental, this sort of network of NGOs, and it just sort of echoes across that entire matrix, and everybody ends up kind of singing from the same
songbook. Like Greenpeace and WWF have been involved right from the get-go, especially Greenpeace. I'd say Greenpeace is, aside from We Don't Have Time, when involving in Greta, is like absolutely there at the beginning. And even if you go back, again, like I documents. I link everything. I'm very, very concise in the work that I present. Basically, you go back and you can see, like I sort of spell out all these connections and walk you through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk you through it from the beginning. Like even We Don't Have Time, back, way before Greta. I don't have my notes in front of me or my computer, but I'm thinking early August, maybe August 12th, and maybe even the month prior. Extinction Rebellion is already tweeting, "We don't have time." Like, you've got a youth climate march last July, and then you've got the climate group, which is an institution that represents all the most powerful corporations on the planet. And also the climate group is one of the six co-founders of We Mean Business with the B-Team series, different groups. I mean, we're just talking all throughout the globe, the most powerful corporations on the planet. You have them tweeting, "Zero Hour, We Don't Have Time," way back in July.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you go back and you see that this didn't just, it's not spontaneous, all this stuff didn't happen. This is being rolled out.
That seems to be the key, that boost that she's got is the key to the profile that she's gotten. Maybe we need to just kind of remind a lot of our listeners about what is concerning about the nonprofit, this network of nonprofits. Because I mean, you know, a lot of people might just sort of casually think, well, okay, I mean, people are getting together and they're sharing notes, and okay. People are looking for just the right ways, because I mean, we're talking about fairly, you know, they've got some fairly good financial resources behind them. I mean, like WWF and so on, and so they, you know, would no doubt have the ability to focus group and develop just the right wording and just the right tools to figure out what would resonate with the broader public. So it's,
again, I go through and I go back and I find out where the hashtags and that have been created, and they're not new. They didn't just start all of a sudden spontaneously, in November, December, January. All these things were already created and being discussed and used. I think it's super important to clarify this is not about Greta per se. This is about the exploitation of a young woman that I've never actually seen anything like it. I mean, I've done a pile of work on the nonprofit industrial complex and how they, manipulate and how they do all kinds of horrible things, especially in countries like Libya, Syria, Latin America. But I've never seen this level of exploitation with a young woman whose her mother has said has had serious, issues in the past, like a very fragile young woman. So I think it's really grotesque, the exploitation. And again, like these groups that we're talking about, people see them as, representing civil society, but that's actually so far from the truth. They represent the corporations and foundations that finance them, and in so many cases that have created them in the first place. And so when we talk about Greenpeace and we talk about WWF and Avaaz and 350, they're not against, the people at the top that oppress the working class and actually destroy our shared environment and have been the primary, the primary ones that contribute to climate change. They're all on the same team. And this is really, really the problem. And then when people come up, especially youth, they are instantly scooped up. You know, and in this instance, the youth are being, like, this is part of the campaign. Like, this is all on the backs of the youth to make all this happen. And it's disgusting because what it is, they're actually taking the energy of the youth and they're channeling it back in to what they're going to roll out. And that will destroy the very things that the youth are asking for and believe that they'll get. As people will realize as they go through the series, this, and this is, you know, fairly ironic, but not surprising at all, this has nothing to do with our environment or mitigating climate change at all. This is about untapped markets. This is about the capitalist system in a free fall, stagnant global economy. This is about unlocking new money to keep this capitalist system afloat. Al Gore and his climate reality project, I think this is in part two. We talk in depth about his hedge fund that he set up with David Blood from Goldman Sachs. It's called Generation Investment. And, you know, we have quotes from Gore in there. This is not about a different system. This is not about getting rid of capitalism. This is about capitalism. You know, and then they throw all kinds of terms on it, compassionate capitalism, sustainable capitalism, all these ridiculous terms to make people feel better. And then we go through actually what Generation Investment invests in, and then we take a really good example that we found in Africa, Mkopa Solar. And then you see a real live example of what this idea a sustainable revolution looks like in Africa. And what it is a whole year's wages for a 24-inch solar TV. I mean, it's just greed and exploitation at its very, very best or worst, whatever you want to call it. It is unbelievably disgusting. And, you know, this is one of the key people behind this whole mobilization that we're seeing right now. And then to get back to the point I just made that it's not about climate, right, when was it? Not too long ago, I believe it was the end of September, it was announced the Climate Finance Partnership. That's what this is about, okay? So this is IKEA, this is all like great big huge foundations working with government. This is all about unlocking money to keep this economy afloat, to protect the capitalist system. And this will be in part four, and it's actually mind-blowing. Where does the money come from? Pensions. That's one thing. I mean, we need $90 trillion to build, the Davos, what people don't even realize that was about the fourth industrial revolution. You know, there's pictures of Greta and Jane Goodall, and the background has been airbrushed out where it says Salesforce, Fourth Industrial Revolution. The pictures have actually been altered.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually mind-blowing. And then even the documents on how to switch that, how to turn that switch on to make the public go into climate emergency mode, to unlock this huge, massive injection of wealth that's needed, money that's needed to keep the economy going, to keep all the power, to protect all the power structures that are currently in place. That's, I forget where I was even going with that. All that money, this is actually mind-blowing. Hmm. The money is not even for the climate. It's being packaged under the climate. The money is for growth markets, untapped markets, and growth in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. So all this hype that we're going to save the environment and the climate is a lie.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. There is a saying, a way of framing the objectives of the powerful, the corporations, the governments. It's called a problem, reaction, solution. It's a mechanism by which, you know, unpopular measures, you know, a strategy which you frame something so that you get the objective that you want. And so a comparison, you know, in terms of what my understanding of what you're talking about here. So, for example, in the case of 9/11, problem, there are terrorists out there. Okay, the reaction, people are scared. And so the solution that's provided is we're going to go bomb oil-rich countries and we're going to boost spending on militarism and defense contractor, lucrative defense contracts and mass surveillance and so on and so forth. So you've sculpted, you know, this is what you wanted to achieve, but you've found an interesting way of framing it. And so it sounds like here, and I think we do need to clarify that you and I both recognize that the climate science, you know, that, you know, we're not questioning climate science at all. We do recognize that the climate change is a problem. You know, there's the reaction that, well, you know, it's definitely a daunting future that we're facing. But the solution that's being provided is not going to, you know, enhance the climate at all, alleviate that situation at all. It's just going into people's pockets and in all kinds of fairly nefarious ways. So that's, but we need to make that distinction that we're not questioning climate science itself, which it seems a lot of people who follow you do.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, this is about $90 trillion in brand new infrastructure and you know, all that. That's the way to look at that. Should be $90 trillion of further plundering of our planet. $90 trillion worth of fossil fuels that will be used to further create all that devastation, all that, you know, there's not even enough. Even at, this has been going on for years, documents that are brought into the COP meetings, COP 20, you know, 23, 24, 25, there's not even enough metals. I mean, scientists are submitting papers saying we don't have enough natural resources left to even do this type of thing. You know, this whole idea of this fourth industrial revolution, especially the way it's been designed with the Climate Finance Partnership in the fall, they're going to take money from the pension. There's like $100 trillion locked up in pension money and institutions. The trick is, and this is a term that they use at these conferences, how do we unlock it? This is about unlocking public money. This is about taxpayer money, unlocking the treasuries. This is about keeping capitalism afloat.
Well, let's talk about, like, the, for example, the Paris Agreement. Now, everybody is talking about this as a strategy for, eliminating. We want to keep emissions below. We want to keep the temperatures, average temperature below 2 degrees above baseline. And I think people, it has this veneer of being about climate. And as I've reflected on the free trade debates of the 1980s between Canada and the United States, everybody's saying it's a free trade agreement. Well, it's not really about trade. Only one chapter deals with trade. It's really about things like intellectual property rights and energy and investor state dispute settlement mechanisms and that sort of thing. And so, in the case of Paris, I mean, we have to look at things fairly critically and recognize that dealing with climate, that it's not really, the focus here isn't about addressing climate. It's my interpretation of what you're saying is that it's really just in place to kind of help create a consensus around this shift, this unlocking of trillions of dollars, as you put it.
Yeah, I mean, business people that go, corporations and business people that go to the climate conferences are the first ones to even say that, that this is, you know, they're referred to as the biggest business meetings annually in the world now. Like, they're about business. And, you know, like, they sell, quote-unquote, climate solutions under this beautiful, you know, under this beautiful guise of solar panels and windmills, and they make, and they have trees behind it and fields, and they have this beautiful holistic packaging. And then everyone thinks, oh, you know, windmills and turbines, we're going to do that, you know, cover the planet needs and everything will be great. When, meanwhile, not even that those things are good, those things are also, you know, plunder and devastate the planet as well. But this is not even about that. This is about carbon capture storage. Like, if anyone follows and reads this stuff, the whole, like, the phrase of reducing emissions, that's gone. Now it's drawing down carbon.
Decarbonization.
Yeah, we don't talk about any more emission reductions, reducing emissions, no emissions. It's drawing down carbon, decarbonization, right? And so language is really, really important. And this is about nuclear. It's about carbon capture storage, which barely even exists. But if we can, unlock that money, we can build to stay under 2 degrees. They're saying that we need about almost 400 carbon capture storage facilities on the planet, which is unbelievable, you know. And it's not even based in reality.
Mm. Well, they also talk about enhanced oil recovery,
yes.
Bioenergy with yes. carbon capture. So they take the carbon and turn it into a synthetic fuel to kind of, like, recycling.
Yeah, also that helps get oil out of the ground. I mean, all of this is about more fossil fuels. Obviously, all of this has to be built on using fossil fuels, more digging, more mining, more. It's all about more. This isn't about conserving. This isn't about, you know what, how do we really start to, you know, the degrowth process? Should we look at, you know, rationing? How are we really, really going to figure out how to conserve and cut out all, you know, maybe cut out all production of things that we don't need? Like, how are we going to handle it in that respect? It's all about more of everything, you know? And that's, if you understand the system, like, it's a lot easier to see how all this stuff operates and functions. All these things, like the Green New Deal, which actually we should mention, they have plans to create international, global Green New Deals all across the world. At the same time, we've seen on 350 pushing a Green New Deal for Canada. Now we've got WWF promoting, what is it? I just saw it yesterday or today, New Deal for Nature. It's called New Deal for Nature, which is the financialization, privatization of every single service that nature provides for free, put a price on everything. This is all being done under the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN, which all of these people, you know, go through, like all these... you know, everyone from Abbas has been, in one way or another, been through the UN in some way or another, through internship or job positions. Everyone goes through that corridor.
I'm wondering if you could, you know, maybe help our listeners, like, maybe secure in their own minds this idea that the Paris Accord isn't what it seems or what it's being billed as is a, you know, the world coming together to address this common threat, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. It's sort of like, I don't know if we talked about this before on one of the shows we did, but it's sort of like Jeremy Hyman's co-founder of Avaaz and the PR, New York PR firm Purpose, which is the sister arm of the VAS, sort of like what he said before the People's Climate March, I believe, back in 2014, you know, the green economy is dead. We need to kill the green. We need to kill the green word to save it. In order to save green, we have to, or sorry, in order to save, I guess, the green economy, we're going to have to kill green. So basically that's when they rebranded everything to the new economy, right? And basically he said, we're going to sell the green economy, but we're not going to say it is what we're selling. And so that's, you know, right away you saw that happen. Like that actually just vanished for a long time. And we heard new terms like new economy, new systems, all kinds of different terminologies being thrown around. But for instance, we don't have time. Aside from the software app where you can make or break politicians or products depending on who has, you know, the best advertising and the best marketing campaign. A third of that whole concept, you know, one of the three pillars is carbon offsets. You know, so Michael, you know what carbon offsets are, obviously, and that's just business as usual, right? Like yeah. You burn your carbon and you pay somebody else an offset. You know, it again, it's like a market instrument, right? And it just allows you to keep doing what you're doing. But it's actually worse than that because now corporations can, you know, further privatization of forests and lands through those offsets, and it creates another billion-dollar industry. And so it's basically business as usual, carbon offsets, you know, pay to alleviate your guilt, you know.
So you basically it means like you can like do all sorts of really heavy industry and but you know you'll make up for it by financing some, you know, the growing a forest or something in some other area.
Or you can say, oh, if you don't touch that forest, I'm going to pay this much for, so, you know, 100 carbon credits to protect that forest. Well, that forest was already there, right? So it actually hasn't changed anything except for create, like, a new market of trade and commerce. I mean, for instance, someone with a huge carbon footprint, and I'll use Al Gore as an example, since he actually says that he lives a carbon-free lifestyle because he buys offsets. I mean, the idea of that is just so ridiculous. So that's just one thing, you know. And then the Paris Accord, when was that? What year was that? When they announced, what was it, Michael? Mission Innovation?
Yeah.
Bill Gates?
Yeah.
Right? And so that's like a huge thing. And if you go into the one campaign I saw, I think it's called Off. Michael Swift was telling me about it. So I found the actual legislation in the States, and it's Off Fossil Fuels. And you get down to number 5, and actually Bill Gates is mentioned right in the legislation. Like, again, it's about, it's not what you see and what is being sold to you. It's about what you don't see, right? What's actually really happening behind the scenes at the conferences, on paper, through the sustainable development goal, or the global goals, sustainable development goals through the UN. We're talking expansion of nuclear, you know, carbon capture storage, what we've already talked about. What's the other one? Michael Swift knows everything about this stuff.
Well, the enhanced oil recovery.
And enhanced oil recovery, which actually serves to get oil out of the ground better. Right, for like depleted oil wells, or you know, so again, we've got all these decarbonization, drawing down carbon. We're talking geoengineering here. You know, we're talking again, new markets, new technologies. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates, you know, and it's even worse because you've got Branson, you've got Bill Gates, you've got Breakthrough Energy, which is all nuclear, which was, again, was that brought out at the same time?
Yeah.
Was it? Breakthrough? And so you've got all these co-founders of Breakthrough. I think it's about 20 of the richest people on the planet. But who's going to pay for all this? We are. Mm-hmm. Right? The rich get richer. I mean, again, this whole, the whole financing thing, it's how to unlock the 100,000 or 100 trillion, what is it? The number is so huge. $100 trillion locked up in pensions and institutional investments. I mean, they don't even spend their own money, right?
Yeah.
And it all goes back to them. Again, it's like taking from, again, all the money goes up from the bottom right to the top. And that inequality, that divide just gets...
And we're also talking about government enforcing these strategies, you know, investment in decarbonization strategies, kind of like, you know, when they talk about a Green New Deal. I mean, this is invoking the language of FDR and, you know, how they used government money to create jobs, lay down infrastructure, and that became a mechanism for, you know, enhancing the social fabric. But in this instance, we're talking about, compelling the use of some of these actually largely unproven technologies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of people even on the right side of the spectrum that say, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, there's just no way this is even possible. And here it is, the premise of keeping under 2 degrees. Mm-hmm. And by the way, 2 degrees is a lie too. It's always been 1 degree.
Yeah, you
so
brought
far
that.
Gone from
yeah.
That.
Yeah, you came up with that that document from, was it UN?
1990.
Yeah, 1990, 1 degree. I wonder, maybe you could just back up a little bit. We were talking about this We Don't Have Time firm and then their app that basically ranks different companies or groups according to their sustainability quotients or what have you. You made an interesting observation that the system is somewhat skewed and that, you know, white Western values are end up being incorporated into it. I mean, there's a subsection of your series, you called it We Don't Have Time Software App, The Latest Wave of Western Corporate Ideology at Your Fingertips. You know, where basically you're rating brands, products, corporations, you know, that's everything else climate rate related. And it seems as if the flaws in this ranking system, you basically, according to your level of sustainability and climate stewardships, those old IQ tests, they're rife with subconscious Western and white cultural norms. And I wonder, maybe you could just point out an illustration of where the blind spots in this.
If that was already. On the market and in people's hands right now, we'd have right now, especially with this huge wave, this huge frenzy of climate emergency stuff happening, we'd have everyone that the NGOs reach via their apps, everyone would be demanding for the Paris Agreement, for all countries to be aligned with the Paris Agreement. I mean, that's what Greta says her one goal is. All countries have to be in line with the Paris Agreement. So that would happen, right? You'd have just this mass movement demanding it. So basically, we are demanding what they already have ready to further oppress us. We're demanding our own oppression. Like, they don't have to impose their will on us. We will demand it. And so, again, reality turned on its head. So that's an example of where that app would really, really be utilized to bring in that, have all the countries. Like, even right now, they're passing. You can see every day countries passing climate emergency acts. it on some level of government, right? So again, that's to, once that's created, then you can do budgets, and then you have to come up with the money, start unleashing the money. That's where all the money is going to come from. But another example would be like when the NGOs tried to help to stabilize Bolivia not too long ago, what they can do and what they usually do, they'll say, you know, oh, whatever government, whatever socialist government they don't want. They're cutting down, you know, part of the rainforest for a road, right? They'll say that wherever, something like that. And then everyone clamors aboard, oh, no, no, that's wrong. Even if the indigenous people want it, it doesn't matter what the, you know, white populace has to say. In America, for some reason, their opinion matters more than the people that actually live there. But you get this huge wave of dissent going against the socialist leader, even though, I mean, we're destroying our own boreal and our own rainforest faster, you know, than anyone can even fathom. And we don't even mention that. We go after a different country, right, what they're tearing down, even though all their resources get swallowed up by us. I mean, the people there aren't even using them themselves. That's just another component of how ridiculous and, you know, how ridiculous that is. But the app could be used to destabilize leaders. I mean, you create acquiescence of a populace to go in and you know, look what happened in Libya, same thing. Like, you create that acquiescence. And so this app would definitely serve to do that. And it's the people with time and money that are connected to the Internet and have the time and the luxury, you know, their demographic that they're appealing to. I mean, people out working, laboring in fields aren't going to be on these apps, right? Like, the people at the bottom of the capitalist system, those exploited most, they're not going to be, they don't have the luxury of sitting at their table and looking, you know, reading, you know, Avaaz and 350 petitions and everything else. They're trying to live. Yeah. They're trying to survive.
Often by, yeah, they're mining the coltan in Congo that you're going to end up being, that's going to end up in the very phones that you're
exactly. Expressing your solidarity. And even Greta was featured with Jane and Goodall at Davos, and am I pronouncing it right? Davos.
I think it's Davos.
Davos, yeah. Whatever it's called. Davos. You know, they had Jane Goodall come in and, like I told you, they actually airbrushed out the background, that Fourth Industrial Revolution, Salesforce, and there she is trying to save her guerrillas that are basically almost gone because of all the conflict minerals.
Mm.
And yet there she is promoting a Fourth Industrial Revolution. So much of this is just insane.
We're so conditioned
now.
Yeah, what's being called, like, people have this simplistic idea that, well, this is the renewable energy economy, the green economy. It's actually green imperialism.
Yeah, yeah, but they've done such a good job of marketing it as clean. You know, it's just like how we perceive our computers are so clean, and look at them, they're so clean, and now I don't use paper and all this, and we don't even think about the amount of energy and the amount of, like, just this massive amount of energy it takes to cool all these, you know, where they keep all the data. I mean, it just, it keeps doubling and doubling and doubling and doubling, and it's just, again, like, this massive thing that no one talks about, you know, and the clean energy, you know, again, quotes around it, that is definitely just green imperialism all over. I mean, the whole definition of sustainability is what's very much in the area where you live, right? And that's what you live on. That's the whole concept of sustainability. I mean, not to go and plunder, you know, halfway across the world and bring it back, all the colonists. I mean, it's just I mean, our collective ability to think these things out critically and discuss them, it just seems to be gone.
Yeah, it's probably deliberately manipulated right there. Kind of running on a little bit low on time, would you want to just maybe say then what an uncoopted environmental movement, like without these Wall Street imbued nonprofits, if you had a more pure and authentic environmental movement that could act as a beacon for young people, what would you say it would look like?
That's a really good question. I mean, even Extinction Rebellion, I think they were chose because the core group in the UK, and actually, I believe it started in France. I could be wrong about that, but that's Macron was one of the key people that brought this finance agreement together a couple months ago, the Climate Finance Partnership. So it's obviously why they're getting so much exposure and, you know, promotion in the media, you know, because that helps, again, what we're talking about, unleash, create that emergency and create that push and drive to unleash all this money. But a good example, and I don't think there is an example that could be global, just like everything else, it's not sustainable, you know, at a global scale. But there's a group I came across not too long ago through Wrong Kind of Green on the page, and they're a small fracking grassroots group, and they actually really, really have educated themselves on the dangers of the nonprofit industrial complex, you know, and they have a website and they publish, you know, a lot of really excellent critical thinking articles. Like they really, really educate themselves and protect themselves against that co-optation, and they're doing really good things in their community and protecting it against fracking, and they've done a great job, you know, and they're not compromising and they're not working, you know, kowtowing to corporate powers or trying to get foundation money. Like, I think, you know, I'd love to see what it would look like if the money did disappear, because I would love everyone that's in this manufactured movement. I know without money, they would all be gone in a heartbeat. Like, they don't, to be blunt, so many just don't give a about the environment or the climate or anything other than saving, you know, human civilization, saving humans, meaning white humans. Like, they really don't care. And I'd love that to open up and see who we're left with and, you know, start having authentic people that actually really, really care about the environment and about each other, like our brothers and sisters across the planet, that we should be, you know, with that privilege, we should be using it to educate our youth about what imperialism is, you know, about who it affects, about who it destroys, you know, the same with the capitalist system. I think if we could, if that system, the nonprofit industrial complex, was to be dismantled, it would, you know, just like a plant breaking out of a concrete sidewalk, I think there's a lot that could be accomplished.
Just going to remind our listeners again that you can find the entire series, the Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent, on the Wrong Kind of Green site at wrongkindofgreen.org, as well as on her own site, theartofannihilation.com. Corey, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Corey Morningstar, independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.